my town. Brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is not Rick Smith. This is Pat LaMarche. Rick has the night off. He's out rabble-rousing because we have to get ready. We are headed to Pittsburgh. I love Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh's one of my favorite places. In fact, George Washington is rumored to have stood at the Three Rivers, point on the Three Rivers there where that little island is. I think it's an old, there's an old stockyard there for an old slaughterhouse now. But he stood there and he looked out and he said, this is the most beautiful sight in North America. That's what George was saying, paraphrasing. May have said America. That's what he thought. Most beautiful sight in North America. Pittsburgh is just, I love it when you come through the tunnel and the old city just opens up before you and it's just a gorgeous, and I'm so excited. We're going to hit the road next week, just like a little mini people's tour. We're going to hang out with some really cool peeps out there and we're going to broadcast live from Pittsburgh or, yeah. Yeah, we'll be broadcasting. So, stay tuned all next week. It'll be really interesting. We'll have some great folks to chat with. And I don't know. I'm sure Pittsburgh has food unique to Pittsburghians. I'll have to check that out. Do they still make, what is that, Iron City beer? Iron City beer, I think we used to get it for the Steelers games, have somebody to bring it up to New England when we were watching Steelers games. But anyway, I'm looking forward to it. It'll be nice, but poor old Rick, he's off running crazy trying to get ready for that show, so those shows next week. So you've got me, Pat LaMarche. I'm in tonight. We're going to have a show that, I mean, if you're easily bothered by things that are bothersome, you might just want to do some deep breathing and relax to listen to this program because some really whacked out stuff has been going on and we're going to talk about it. But first, I want to talk about the thing that is not whacked out. I did that thing that so many people are saying don't do now. I did it this weekend. Some people have been doing it. Some people have been very upset that they did it. Some people have said that other people shouldn't do it. Some people have said they wish they hadn't done it. I did it. And I laughed from beginning to end. I was the only person laughing. It's tough when you go to do something that a lot of other people are doing and you're laughing and they aren't. Sometimes you think maybe they don't get the joke. And then sometimes you think maybe they think I'm laughing at them. You know what I did, don't you? That's right. I went to see Noah. Oh, my God. It is a funny, funny movie. Oh, did I say oh, my God? Oh, holy Moses, I love that movie. I mean, the jokes just write themselves, don't they? Honestly, go see Noah. First of all, it's hysterical. Second of all, if you go see Noah and you don't laugh from beginning to end, your ha-ha's broken. You're uptight. You're too serious. You need a chill pill. That movie is hysterical. Russell Crowe and the guy that made it. Who's the director? Darren Aronofsky or something like that. First of all, really, honestly, have you sat down and thought about the two of everythings? Really? On a boat? It rains for 40 days and 40 nights, and that's not when they get off the boat. Then it's got to dry up. Two of everything on a boat. If you go see Noah and you don't just wet your pants laughing when you see how Noah makes that work, you have no sense of humor. Anthony Hopkins is in it. He is hysterical. Never thought of him as a comedic actor before. The movie's great. And if you're one of those religious people who gets really uptight, like, oh, all right, I've gone to the Carlisle Theater to probably see, I haven't lived here very long, 5 years or so, so I haven't seen maybe 60 movies, maybe 12 movies a year. I love movies. I might have seen 60 movies in the time I've lived here. I've never been in a movie theater so crowded. It was packed. I was the only person laughing. There is something wrong with that. People who take things that seriously. First of all, it's Hollywood. If you believe that all the accounts in the Bible are true, did you really expect them to show up in a movie? Someone said Stephen King books don't even come out the way they said they would. You know, the way he wrote the book. Look at The Shining. How many people criticize The Shining? So it diverges from the book a little bit. Just a little bit, though. I mean, the two of everything on the boat, that wasn't made up by, what's his name, Aronofsky. That was made up by the Bible. A whole pile of civilization coming from just men. Adam and Eve have three sons. And then Noah and his wife have three sons. Isn't anybody wondering how the whole civilization came around with all these boys? Anyway, miracles, of course. You need miracles. I'm not giving away the movie here because you've probably read the book. So put on your sense of humor. Go see Noah. Relax. Don't be so uptight. If you believe that the Bible is true and the Word of God, then you shouldn't be upset either. Because it's a movie. It's a movie by Hollywood. And if you're a fundamentalist who's, first of all, listening to the show, that's wonderful and we'd like to meet you. But if you're a fundamentalist who takes exception with Hollywood, I think that's probably fair to say you probably do. Why are you upset that they made a movie you don't think is accurate? But honest to Pete, haven't you really wondered how all that stuff happened? And if Cecil B. DeMille, isn't he the one who made the Ten Commandments? You know, really? Frogs and boils and stuff? You know, the angel of death? All that stuff? This is all miracles, right? And the forbidden fruit stuff, and then Noah's like the first three books of Genesis, you know, plays out in this movie. And anyway, do yourself a favor. Go see the movie. It is hysterical. Wear your happy face. Don't go all grumpy and thinking that, you know, it's not going to be a Bible service. It's not going to be like going to church, because it's not. It is not going to church. It is going to the movies. Buy yourself some popcorn. Have a nice time. Enjoy yourself. There. Now that I've put this all in the proper perspective, we're going to have a heck of a show tonight. We're going to speak to two young women. If you were listening last week, then you heard the discussion over whether or not it was actually very fair for, not even fair, something other than creepy, for these dads to be taking their daughters to purity balls. Purity balls, a ball like a dancing ball. For the dads to take their daughters to purity balls, give them wedding rings. For the daughters to pledge their virtue to their fathers. Are you kidding me? Anyway, we were talking about this, and in the course of talking about it, I was contacted by a couple of women. One of the women literally got the ring and everything from her dad. She's brought up in the South. And she got the ring from her dad, and she was given the whole falderal and brought up in this way of thinking. Another woman was brought up also in a very fundamentalist family, and she was sent to a Bible camp where all of the little girls were given these rings in sort of a mass ceremony. Both of these women really wanted to get this off their chest, and they're going to do that tonight. We're going to be speaking with these two young women about what they're now both probably the one's in her early 30s and one's in her late 20s, talking about how their lives progressed after they made these pledges and after they made these deals about what to do with their most private thoughts and how they acted on them as they grew and matured into young women. And then before that, we're going to speak with Susan Feiner, who's a economics professor. She is going to talk to us about everything from the minimum wage. Joe Biden said last weekend, 10-10, we need to be up to $10.10, blah, blah, blah. We'll know about that. But we also want to talk about tenured professors being fired, which has happened at her university, like dropping like flies in the last couple of weeks. So we're speaking to Susan Feiner, economist, economics professor. And then after, at the very end of the show, we're going to take a few minutes and we're going to talk to a therapist who will have listened to the whole program. And he will tell us what he thinks about what has happened to these young women who have gone through this process. Anyway, in the meantime, first of all, though, I want to talk about the DuPont Air. I don't know if you saw this story. It's been everywhere now. It's in the New York Times, Huffington Post. But the story I have in front of me is from the Delaware newspaper, the News Journal. And a Superior Court judge sentenced a wealthy DuPont heir to probation for raping his 3-year-old daughter. Okay, we're going to back up. A Superior Court judge sentenced a wealthy DuPont heir, you know, DuPont Chemical, to probation for raping his 3-year-old daughter. She noted in her order, the judge is a woman, she noted in her order that he will not fare well in prison. Well, more than a few people have said, nobody fares well in prison. By the way, we hope he doesn't fare well in prison. He raped his 3-year-old daughter. Judge Jan Jordan's sentencing order for Robert Richards IV suggested that she considered unique circumstances when deciding his punishment for fourth-degree rape. Her observation that prison life would adversely affect Richards was a rare and puzzling rationale, according to criminal justice authorities in Delaware and everywhere. Some also said that in her view, this treatment would be better if he just got some psychiatric treatment and didn't go to jail. Okay, well, what about all the little drug dealers that are in jail who probably could benefit from psychiatric treatment or chemical dependency treatment? This guy's a pedophile, and it wasn't just a 3-year-old, it was his own daughter. He's an incestuous pedophile. And the fact that this happened wouldn't even be out in public if his ex-wife hadn't demanded that the sealed sentencing be opened up so that she could do what she could to protect her daughter. And I think that woman deserves a fruit basket. We've got to send the ex-wife a fruit basket for fighting this hard to protect her daughter. Amazing. Well, if you were listening a few weeks ago, you heard Dan Musick on with Rick when Rick was here. Dan Musick is the guy who made that really outrageous video, Thanks, Dan, where the crooks and the criminals all thank him for a good defense. He's a defense attorney out of Pittsburgh. We're going to talk with Dan about, you know, he's fighting tooth and nail to keep people out of jail. And then this guy with more money than God gets to stay out of jail, even though he raped his 3-year-old daughter. We're going to talk with Dan coming right up. I'm Pat LaMarche, filling in for Rick Smith. This is the Rick Smith Show, and we'll be right back.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. At least 9.5 million more Americans have health insurance coverage thanks to the Affordable Care Act, according to state and federal reports and surveys. 6 million have signed up for insurance under the Health Care Reform Act's state exchanges. More specific numbers will be available in coming months, but the picture emerging is that the health care reform known as Obamacare has created the largest expansion of health insurance coverage to uninsured Americans in 50 years. According to reporting in the Los Angeles Times, survey data and reports from insurance companies show there's been no net reduction in coverage from policy cancellations, despite the claims from some Republicans that cancellations last fall would lead to a net reduction in coverage. The health care reform has made a sizable dent in the total number of uninsured Americans, according to polls from Gallup and from RAND. AFSCME District 48 in Milwaukee is suing Milwaukee County in federal court on behalf of janitors laid off by Governor Scott Walker when he was Milwaukee County Executive. The suit alleges violation of the workers' constitutional right to free association under the First Amendment. The workers charged that after they were laid off in 2009, Milwaukee County refused to call them back, rehire them, or provide them with references because of their association with AFSCME District 48. AFSCME District 48's Boyd McCamish.
Scott Walker purposely intended to harm folks for their union affiliation. That's a violation of the law. And number two, conveniently, the company that took over the work was a major campaign contributor to Scott Walker during that time and still is to this day. So we feel that the custodial workers at the courthouse, their civil rights have been violated. They were essentially penalized for political and union affiliation, and that is a violation of the law.
AFSCME says that the county was acting on recommendations from Walker. Walker privatized Milwaukee County janitorial services, giving the work to a company owned by a Walker campaign contributor. One email among the many thousands recently released from the first John Doe criminal probe into Walker's Milwaukee County executive days has Walker's then chief of staff saying that Walker should punish AFSCME members, urging Walker to, quote, furlough the hell out of them and find the most senior members and, quote, burn them a new one. A minimum wage increase signed into law in Connecticut on Thursday will raise the state minimum to $10.10 an hour by 2017. It's the first state in the nation to enact that minimum wage. But for working people waiting for it, it increases very slowly to $9.15 an hour in 2015,
$9.60 by 2016, and then to $10.10 in 2017. In Connecticut, between 70,000 and 90,000 people earn the minimum wage. The U.S. Labor Department says nationally about 5% of all hourly workers are paid at or below the federal minimum of $7.25 an hour.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Fight for the real American, and fight to keep some people like, I don't know, this, what's his name, Robert Richards IV, DuPont heir, rapes his three-year-old daughter, and the judge thinks that he won't fare well in jail. I'm Pat LaMarche, filling in for Rick Smith. Rick's taking the night off to get ready for a big trip to Pittsburgh next week. I can't wait. And I am so excited that I've got Dan Music on the air with me. I'm his new BFF. He just doesn't know it because I love his video. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Hey, first of all, I looked the other day, 279,000 views now on YouTube. And, you know, the next lawyer after you has got like nine.
Nice. Yeah. Most legal commercials just don't really have a lot going on,
Yeah, for the most part, you don't watch one unless you know you've just had the little bracelets on. But
right, exactly.
But yours is worth watching. Everybody right
Thank
now,
you.
Go to – we'll throw it up on the Facebook page, too, so folks can watch it. But Dan
awesome.
Music.
Thank you so much.
You are a defense attorney, and in your – you know, quite honestly, a good defense is part of the American way, right? You don't get hung out to dry. Like that poor,
yeah, absolutely.
Like that, that poor guy in Louisiana who just got out of jail after 30 years serving a death sentence on death row because, oh, by the way, he didn't do it. You know, a good defense.
Right. Sometimes
is,
I wonder if there's anyone in jail in Louisiana who actually did it.
I've been to Louisiana several times. I'm willing to say no.
Yeah, I was gonna say. It gets to be like that sometimes.
Absolutely. Now, so I called you yesterday because actually we were hoping to get you on last night's show, and I lucked out and got to chat with you now because I'm filling in. But I was incredulous. A kid who's dealing drugs a couple of times or three strikes, you're out, and all this other crap going on in the world, and this guy who there's no doubt he raped his three-year-old daughter?
Yeah, I mean, it really does kind of like strain your, you know, credulity, doesn't it? You know, it really is mind-blowing.
Did someone, I realize that this is one of those questions you probably don't want to answer, but did someone pay this judge off? How do you get away with, like, probation for raping your kid?
Well, I mean, you know, I did some research into the type of crime that it was in the state. So I guess he got convicted of a Class B felony in Delaware. And in Delaware, for a Class B felony, which was like the kind of rape that he was convicted of, the specific type, you know, the sentence goes, I think, anywhere from 0 to 8 years. So it is within, it's not like he, you know, it's not like it was unprecedented that he got off. He just escaped with a sentence at the lowest end of the range that he could possibly get.
Now, my understanding from reading newspapers, which isn't always helpful, but my understanding from reading about it is that it was his ex-wife in desire to, A, protect her daughter, and, oh, make sure that their nest was nice and thick, but, you know, to raise her daughter,
right.
Got this stuff unsealed. So what kind of a rape? I mean, is rape the wrong word for what he did to her then? I mean, I don't want any rape to get zero time.
Right. Yeah, that's the issue that's kind of difficult to discern. I mean, from what I could understand from the statute, it seemed like it meant rape and, you know, in a pretty close to the definition that it was in the Commonwealth. I mean, maybe a Delaware criminal practitioner would say I'm in remiss there.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think the deal is that with Delaware, they had a lot of classes of rapes and a lot of classes of felonies. And, you know, for whatever reason, maybe because of the fact that, and this often happens, when the victim is a minor or is not going to be very responsive, it's difficult. You're not going to be able to rely on their direct testimony. Mm-hmm. And in a situation where it's a one-on-one crime, where there's one perpetrator and one victim, the sexual crimes often are, a lot of times they go for a lower crime than maybe the highest degree, because the higher up it gets, usually the rule is it's more difficult to prove.
You've got to get this little 3-year-old to say that her dad did that to her.
Yeah, or just, and also remember that crimes are the statutes that, you know, control criminal behavior in states. They're made up of elements, and the prosecution has to prove every element of the crime. You know, it's like something people forget at home. That's a lot. That's like, I mean, that's 9 times out of 10 when they're like, how do you get at, how did this guy get off or whatever, when it mm-hmm. seems like he was guilty. I mean, yes, he most likely, you know, maybe he was guilty, and he most likely seemed very guilty. But the prosecution, simply because of the facts of the case and how things played out, they weren't able to prove each requisite element to the standard that they needed to.
And the court,
you know,
and it says that.
Yeah, and that happens a lot.
Oh, so you can't really prove it. You know, quite frankly, I'm really glad you exist, Dan, because everybody needs a good lawyer. But I'm kind of sick of the United States of America legal system right now after the whole Zimmerman's
yeah.
thing. And, you know, I mean, I see people walking away with murder. And then I got a friend who's in a federal penitentiary right now for like 4 years for dope.
Right.
And it just kind of makes me nuts. But anyway, according to court records, this guy Richards was 6'4" tall, between 250 and 276 pounds. A 3-year-old?
Yeah, I mean, look. As I'm trying to maintain a sense of professional detachment here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, as a human being, I find, you know, those crimes as reprehensible as everybody else. I'm just honestly trying to offer as many plausible, rational explanations as to like how this happened, besides it being a total miscarriage of justice. My
right.
personal opinion falls in line with yours, however, that it blows my mind that in America, a judge with a straight face can sentence someone to prison for a nonviolent drug crime,
mm-hmm.
and then in the same breath, you know, turn, because I'm sure that judge has sentenced people to prison for nonviolent drug crimes, but
mm-hmm.
if you're a judge in America, you have.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, in the Delaware paper that I read said that she was really tough on everybody.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, although I guess being from a family that pretty much runs Delaware might change things a little bit, right?
Right. Well,
you know, I mean, look, like, you know, it's not a question of, I'm not suggesting any impropriety or whatever. It's just that it's that kind of soft power that people have when you have a lot of money and influence. You know, it's the cultural capital,
mm-hmm.
you know, and actual capital, where you can hire the best defense possible, and you can hire people that have good working relationships with people. And that, you know, you can work to get a good result.
That's what a friend of mine said. He said that he doesn't think this is a crooked judge anywhere near as close to the fact that it's probably the world's slickest attorney that got hired.
Right. I mean, I think it was probably somebody who was highly skilled and connected and, you know, and the type of, you know, magic that someone like that can work is, like I said, it's never anything direct or overt. People tend to have this view of criminal defense attorneys where, you know, there's just this guy that, you know, is like handing off cash to people, or, you know, I'm sure
mm-hmm.
that does happen somewhere in America.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen it happen. I think if anyone tried to do that, they'd go to jail pretty quickly in most places,
mm-hmm.
you know? So it's not that. It's actually like a much less sexy and nuanced answer, which is application of relationships and soft power and you know, little nudges here and
right.
favors there and stuff like that. And it all, in the end, works to the result. It's the same result, but it's perhaps a less overt track of getting there.
I love that phrase, soft power, because you really don't think of it that way. I mean, certainly you think of privilege, and white privilege as being a term that I use quite often for people who don't seem to have a clue about what's different between them and that other guy over there. It doesn't happen to be white. But that soft power is something that people have that are either, I mean, in general, white people, but certainly people who are extremely wealthy or people who are highly educated, doctors.
Right. It's often something that's more entrenched and insidious than actual money.
Mm-hmm.
Because if that were the case, then, you know, any drug dealer that had $150,000 could just simply get themselves out, like it was Mexico or something.
Right, right.
You know, even a mid-level drug dealer would have enough money just to, you know, basically pay the ticket and walk right back out of jail. in America, like you're saying, it's much more subtle, it's much more nuanced than that. It has to do with a variety of factors, at least in my experience, as opposed to, you know, outright financial wealth. But the financial wealth is a key component of being able to produce such a favorable result.
Now, the ex-wife, Tracy, she's filed a lawsuit. Is it likely that, soft power or not, he will ever see his daughter again? Or do you think that this is something that, I mean, rehabilitation for child sex offenders allegedly isn't terribly successful.
Right. And I mean, I'm not an expert in the, you know, criminal procedure of Delaware per se, mm-hmm. but I could say around here, the odds of him having any sort of contact with his daughter as a minor are minimal at best.
Well,
you know, regardless
that.
Of the amount of money that he has, you know, regardless of the influence that he has, all those things, you know, I think it's going to be extremely difficult for him to
get her back. One last question that kind of, we have about 3 minutes. The judge said that he wouldn't fare well in jail. A lot of people say good. But do people in general fare well in jail? I mean, jail's not about faring well, is it? Weeping a lot about the fact that life really sucks for an awful lot of inmates in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, that is odd because, you know, American prisons are extremely tough places to be. They're some of the worst prisons in the first world, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
But you stack them up to the UK and Europe and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
They're really violent. The food is terrible. Healthcare is minimal. You know, they're pretty miserable places. So, yeah, the argument that someone wouldn't fare well in jail, I mean, the only people who fare well in jail are kind of like gang leaders and, you know, maybe really, really tough career criminals. Or, you know, maybe like, kind of like people who are in and out of the system all the time, like drug addicts that,
mm-hmm.
you know, keep cycling in and out. So they're almost used to being in jail. It's like a skill set for them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Aside from them, you know, I think it's really difficult for people to fare well in jail. You know, I understand, like, look, like, you know, that's why we have different security classifications of prison. There's a minimum and maximum and medium. I mean, a lot of places, the federal system has like 6 different classifications based on severity and security. You know, so even states usually have at least 3, sometimes 4 or more.
Well, and aren't there inmates in California right now on a hunger strike because they've been in solitary confinement for 20 years?
Yeah, I mean, California has some crazy stuff going on with Pelican Bay and like the, when they mark someone as an active gang member, they can just pretty much put them in indefinite solitary with like no administrative review.
Wow.
You know?
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, it's bad. It's bad.
Wow. Hey, Dan Musig, the nation's funnest attorney. I hope that we never have a more professional relationship, but if I ever needed someone, you would be my first phone call.
Absolutely. I'm here for you.
Thanks, Dan. Dan Musig, attorney in Pittsburgh, and a real treat to have on the program. I'm Pat LaMarche, filling in for Rick Smith, and we'll be right back.
It was rock and roll. Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show. The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We've been talking about World War II military photographer Bill Jones and the most famous photos he ever snapped. Jones wanted to be a pilot, but he was underweight, so instead of flying in the cockpit, he trained in aerial photography. When the war ended, he was on furlough, but for Bill Jones, wartime service was not yet finished. He was ordered to Japan at the end of 1945. He'd been selected as the official U.S. Army photographer to establish visual documentation of the damage done by the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Jones recorded the devastation in January 1946. He was a 20-year-old corporal. According to interviews, the officers along on the mission felt a different level of energy than any of their wartime missions. There was a special sense of history and curiosity. But join us again for Mr. Jones's movie. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Where's Charles Dickens when we need him? The novelist who laid bare the shame of gross income inequality in 19th century England came up with some perfectly fitting names for his fat cat characters, including Scrooge, Mr. Tulkinghorn, Miss Havisham, and Nickleby. So I'm wondering what moniker Dickens would have given to Robert Marcus. He's the CEO of Time Warner Cable, who has just won gold in the Greed Olympics for grabbing the most gold with the least effort in the shortest time. Marcus became chief of the cable company on January 1st, and he immediately reached out to his corporation's biggest rival, Comcast, offering to sell Time Warner to that giant. Only 6 weeks later, the deal was done. Why would a CEO rush to eliminate both his corporation and his own job? Perhaps because of a lucrative little provision in the contract he signed to become Time Warner's honcho. It's a CCC, a change of control clause. This is yet another way for CEOs to feather their own nest, for a CCC hands a big golden parachute to the top executive of a corporation that gets sold. In this case, Robert pockets $80 million. Yes, that's roughly $1.8 million a day for each of about 45 days he worked to sell the company. What we have here is a perverse form of incentive pay for corporate chieftains. Rather than rewarding them for outcompeting their rivals, a CCC encourages them to sidle up to their competitors and whisper, "Psst, want to buy my corporation?" This is Jim Hightower saying, not only did Marcus sell off Time Warner, but his self-serving deal will also sell out untold numbers of its employees who will be made redundant by the merger. We hear about America's widening gap in income inequality, but here we can actually see it widen. One rich man gains an extra $80 million, and hundreds of workers lose their income.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Exposing GOP hypocrisy, The Rick Smith Show.
That's the provost office of the University of Southern Maine right now, I think. I want it all. I want it now, even if that means I don't have any faculty. I'm Pat LaMarche. Rick Smith's taking the night off. We're getting geared up for our trip to Pittsburgh next week, which I'm very excited about. I think Pittsburgh's a great place. In the meantime, though, there's a move across the country to basically make it impossible to educate the people to have an underclass of slave labor, have people with no options at all. They're privatizing our public education in elementary and high school, and now they're making basically public higher ed, well, not really ed. Joining us right now, Professor Susan Feiner. She's a professor at the University of Southern Maine. Susan, welcome to the Rick Smith Show.
Hi, Pat. It's great to be on the air with you again.
It's great to have you back, and we have so much to talk about and so many the economy, for God's sake, it's just a mess. But you're going to be back on the show Thursday. We'll talk economy then. Let's talk about what the heck is going on at the university. This is a land-grant college.
Not quite.
No?
The land-grant college in the state of Maine is the University of Maine
at
in Orono.
Okay.
And the University of Southern Maine grew out of the satellite campus of the University of Maine, where they essentially offered night school-type classes. And in the 80s, they merged the satellite of Orono with what had been the Teachers College out in Gorham, and they created the University of Portland Gorham, or POCO, as it is affectionately referred to here, and that turned into the University of Southern Maine.
Yeah, but, you know, I'm going to still say, I realize it's not land grant, the fact that I went to Orono first, but it was a chunk of land we stole from the Indians and used the money to finance higher ed, and it operates at a not-profit status, and it should belong to the people. And now, because of government being completely unwilling to fund higher ed and management decisions that I'm going to let you discuss, they have taken tenured professors. These are now, when you're a tenured professor, this is like being invested in a company, right? This is like having your union card.
It's much more. It's much more profound of a relationship than that. Tenure is a contract between faculty and their institution that until a week ago Friday, I thought, and all my colleagues thought, basically meant you could not be fired. It was, you could not be fired except under the most dire of circumstances, because getting tenure was the institution's guarantee to you that you would have the freedom to do your research and teaching in a way that respected your academic freedom. So if you don't have tenure, but you're supposed to be doing research, then you can be fired whenever anybody doesn't like your research. Right. And that's why America came up with the institution of tenure in the 1920s. To protect academic freedom. Now, it hasn't been perfect. During the McCarthy era, a lot of leftist professors got fired, and universities cooked up a bunch of reasons for doing so. But in the current situation at USM, the administration at the university and the administration of the University of Maine system, and the University of Maine system is like a central office. It's not like a central office. It is a central office. And they hold the purse string.
And the legislature sends money to the University of Maine system.
The legislature makes a higher ed appropriation,
mm-hmm.
all of which goes to the central office before the central office doles it out to the campuses. And right from the get-go in Maine, and it's like this in other states too, if you have seven campuses, the state appropriation is not divided into seven equal parts.
Right.
In fact, in Maine, 50 cents of every dollar that the state gives for higher ed goes to Orono. 25 cents of every dollar from the state goes to USM in Portland. And the other five schools fight over the remaining 25 cents. So Orono, as the land-grant college, and because it has so many graduate programs, it has PhD programs, has a significantly higher share of the appropriation.
Can I just interrupt for a minute? I don't know if you're aware, Susan, but what's going on right now in Pennsylvania is they are trying to sell off. They have a very similar system here. You know, everybody knows Penn State, State College, you know, northern part of
mm-hmm.
Pennsylvania. But there are all these other schools, much like Farmington in Maine, the University of Maine. Farmington was the teacher's college. We have Shippensburg here. They're all part of the system. And now the more profitable of profitable being a word, I apologize that
mm-hmm.
I'm using, but the more profitable of these satellite university locations are there are members of the legislature here who are trying to sell them off. I don't know if that's something that's come up in Maine yet, but that's the plan here, you know, just privatize
the whole
them.
Campus to a private to a private for-profit educational institution.
Right.
Oh my God, that's horrible.
I know.
That's just insane. The people of Pennsylvania better not let that happen.
Absolutely, but I'll tell you what, it's like everybody's too busy, they're sleepy, whatever the reason is, this is just sort of being bantered about, and it's very, I mean, right now, from my understanding, it's very likely to pass.
Well, that's very, very, very disheartening.
And I think this is all...
I have not heard that. It's just, I'm stunned beyond belief.
Yeah,
has this been covered in... The Chronicle of Higher Education and the press? Like that?
I can't imagine that it hasn't been. As far as just speaking for myself, there are two things I listen to as far as broadcast in the state of, in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. One is the Rick Smith Show, and the other one is public radio. And public radio is covering it pretty extensively, so I can't imagine it's not being covered elsewhere. Although, I could imagine it's not being covered elsewhere.
Well, that's just stunning to me, especially the piece that I wrote for the Portland Press Herald a couple of weeks ago called Top Heavy University Takes the Low Road. Paul Krugman picked that piece up and blogged about the situation at the University of Southern Maine. And so the whole story just blew up in the national press. And the level of support from around the country for our faculty has been fabulous, but even more fabulous are our students who have just rallied so bravely and so articulately. It's amazing.
Yeah, you're doing a good job. Well, maybe when you're done with what's going on in Maine, we can get you to blog about Pennsylvania. Because really, literally, this does need to be a national story. But I do think it's probably part of some master plan that we're not in on with Alec or the Koch brothers or something.
Well, that's exactly what I suspect. And, you know, there is, I had a conversation yesterday with a very senior person at AAUP. That's the American Association of University Professors, which is like, it's the equivalent of the AMA for doctors.
Right. Hey, so but just a minute before you tell us that story, why don't you back up, because I know more than the listeners do, and tell us what happened. They laid off how many teachers or fired, or what happened that prompted all
what
this?
What happened is that the Wednesday, March 19th, there was a very weird town hall kind of forum with the president of the university and the chancellor of the University of Maine system and a bunch of the board of trustees, in which they lectured us, and it was very weird. And then on Thursday,
and it was just the professors that were in that meeting?
No, it was faculty and staff, and I think there might have, yeah, there were students definitely in that meeting because students spoke out. And they talked about they need to rebrand USM as a metropolitan university and sort of waved their hands around as if rebranding USM as a metropolitan university was going to somehow have thousands of students lining up at our door to take our classes. And
maybe it would be helpful to rebrand Portland as a metropolis first.
Yeah, first. Very good. And then on Thursday, either 18 or 20 faculty, the vast majority of whom were tenured, some of whom were tenure track, and a couple of lecturers. Lecturers do not have tenure, and they're not eligible for tenure. Assistant professors are on the tenure track and are somewhere in their probationary period, and then associate professors are tenured. And so these 18 to 20 people, we're still not sure how many, got these mysterious phone calls from the provost's office saying, you have an appointment at the provost's office at XYZ time. And when people asked what was the meeting about, they said, the person making the call said, I don't know, just be there. And so by the end of the day on Thursday, everybody had figured out that these were meetings in which the faculty were going to be fired.
Wow.
Supposedly from least senior up within the department, that they have decided by some arbitrary measure that they won't tell us what it is, that these departments are not performing up to snuff. Not that we know what performing up to snuff means, but these departments were slated for gutting.
So gutting completely, yeah, and like eliminating departments?
No, there's a move to eliminate four departments that's separate from these terminations.
I see.
These are terminations of faculty in departments that are going to still exist. And that's actually in complete violation of the AAUP standard on tenure and retrenchment, retrenchment being the polite word for firing somebody's ass.
Right. So, but is this a way to basically, to use, you know, layman's talk, union bust so they can hire in a bunch of people cheaper?
Yes, they're already doing that. And in fact, in one very egregious case, one of the professors who was fired was asked, by the chair of the department if they would be willing to teach their courses as a part-time adjunct person that they used to get paid a regular salary for teaching. Is that audacity?
Yeah. We want you to come back after we fired you and teach that stuff, because actually it's not a revamp we're after. It's just a lowering of your pay.
Exactly.
Because that's proof in the pudding right there. They're not trying to change the flavor of the courses. They're trying to change the cost of the courses.
Yes.
Okay, so somebody who would be sitting in a very different radio program than I am would say, don't you want your kid to be able to afford to go to college?
Well, people do cite the increase in the cost of sending your kid to college, and I'm talking here about public school. And actually, the cost per student, if you look at the whole number, hasn't changed all that much. What's changed is the share of the cost that's borne by the state subsidy,
right,
and the share that's borne by the family or the student.
Right.
So if it costs $20,000, say, to educate a college student back in the 1960s, the student might pay $1,000, $2,000, $3,000, and the state would pay $17,000, $18,000,
$19,000
of the tuition. But now, and that share by the state has fallen and fallen and fallen. So now, of the $20,000, the student is being asked to pay, and the state is only paying somewhere between $5,000 and $8,000, you see?
Right.
So it isn't that the total cost has gone up terribly much, although it has gone up some because of health insurance costs. But that's not something that the institutions of higher education can control.
Right. Now, people who know Maine probably only know it right now because of the Governor Paul LePage, who tore down the labor mural and did a whole bunch of other stuff that was really, really stupid and got him national attention. He did give a sizable tax break to the wealthiest in that state that possibly could have
It opened up a giant hole in the budget because it was a tax cut that wasn't paid for.
Right.
And so
now
then
it is.
You get it.
Surprise! Well, they were going to pay for it, Leah.
Yeah, they pay for it by cutting programs.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a very, very standard conservative playbook. Because, you know, you say cut taxes, cut taxes, cut taxes, and everybody loves the idea of their taxes going down. But since states are legally bound to balance their budget, if the taxes go down, then they have to cut spending.
Right.
And where they cut, what state governments do is primarily education, some health care, fire and police, and the DMV, and keep the roads, and water districts. That's all that state governments do, and then maintain the machinery of the state courts so that you can adjudicate contracts and you can deal with criminal activity and so forth. So it's not that very much of what states do is some frivolous stuff like, oh, my God, what if there was the State Theater of Maine and it maintained a professional acting troupe or a, you know, a state Symphony of Maine and you maintained a performance venue. The state of Maine doesn't do anything remotely like that.
Right.
It's all money that's spent very close to delivering services to people.
Now, we toured the country last year on the People's Tour, and we talked to an awful lot of different leaders, but also a lot of college professors. We talked to a lot of historians, and the historian we spoke to in Toledo, who spoke about the great strikes, the great labor strikes of Toledo, he said that the reason they were so successful is because the community was on the side of the worker. People who didn't even work at the particular factory or weren't married to them, just people in the community, the shopkeeper, they took to the streets with the workers. They fought back with the workers, and that was why the companies acquiesced, was because the community was together and not just the people in the workforce. So what I'm hearing you say about what's going on right now in the struggle is to fire these tenured professors and then not, is that you have the community behind you.
I think there's a lot of community support. Of course, we would always like to have more community support.
Mm-hmm.
And we're having what we hope will be a large rally in Monument Square on Tuesday of next week. And there's going to be a teach-in and, you know, a demonstration. And we're hoping that there will be a lot of support for USM that shows up for that event. And that will be kind of a real litmus test of how well the community is responding to the possibility of the largest city in America, north of Boston, not having a college that offers liberal arts degrees. I mean,
they're getting rid of the
stunning
liberal arts degrees?
Yeah, that's where of the 18 to 20, 75% of the cuts that happened on last Friday happened in the liberal arts.
This is the Koch brothers, baby.
Yeah, it happened in theater, in art, in economics, in sociology, in philosophy, and in English.
Oh, English?
Yeah.
Who needs English? Wait a minute, what about all the rednecks who scream, you know, if you can read this, thank a teacher. If you can read it in English, thank a veteran. Now they're getting rid of English professors?
Mm-hmm. And here's another thing. The 11 out of the 15 people who were, no, 11 of the 14 people who were fired are women.
I was going to ask you that because, you know, tonight's show is basically all about beating up on women, like right straight down from the little 3-year-old who was raped by her father, and he's a DuPont heir, so the judge said she was just going to give him probation because he wouldn't fare well in jail. Right? I don't know if you heard about that story. But, you know, from one end to the other of women being the can that gets kicked down the road depending on whatever issue needs a scapegoat. So I was wondering what percentage of the professors at the University of Southern Maine overall are women? Do you know?
Yes, I was just doing that this morning. Before the firing, it was 45% women and 65% men.
But they fired, but 60 or 70% of the people they fired were women.
Right. But yeah. So now, after the firing, the percentage of women in the faculty is down by 1.5%, and the percentage of men on the faculty is up by 1.5%.
So that's disproportionately fired and then yielding a even more lopsided percentage of male
versus female. Right, and this is on a campus where probably pushing 75 to 80% of the students are female.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I'm sure if we polled the men in that faculty, none of them would be happy with the women getting fired, or most of them would not.
No.
The male faculty aren't the ones who are saying, hey, there's too many girls here.
No.
It's coming from somewhere else.
Yeah, this is a situation where the application of a policy looks like it's fair. You know, if you're firing people from the least seniority, then why, you've got a standard that treats everybody fairly. But in practice, it's unfair because the vast majority of the most recent hires are women, because women for a long time were excluded from the ranks of being professors in many, many fields.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and here's something that's crazy. There are professors who are tenured and have been tenured for 5, 10 or more years at USM who were fired.
Mm-hmm.
But there are professors in other departments, like social work or business or engineering or nursing, who are either not tenured or were tenured very recently, and they didn't get retrenched because the provost and the upper administration doesn't want to cut the professional program. What they want to rebrand USM as is basically a glorified trade school. You come to USM for a social work degree or an engineering degree or a business degree, and what will be left of the liberal arts are the sort of basic courses that are needed for students to meet general education requirements. But no major. There won't be a major in English. There won't be a major in economics. There won't be a major in sociology or philosophy or classics. It's really horrifying.
It is horrifying. I feel bad some days because I sent my kids off to college and I said, just go and learn. You know, worry about graduate school for when you need to hone whatever it is you're going to end up doing for the rest of your life, you know. And now I feel bad because no kid finishes college and can afford to hone anything then. That's the first thing. They've made it so ridiculously expensive. Cynthia McKinney says it's a cruel country that puts a banker between a child and an education. But
oh, I like that.
But
I mean, I don't like it, but it's catchy.
Yeah, I've remembered it for years because it's just so true. And so we're now at this point where we've got people who need to exist in a society, people understand the classics and understand
history and understand politics and understand, have an appreciation for the depth of the complexity of the world.
Yeah. Susan, so we've got about 30 seconds left. You're continuing this battle. We're going to have you back on the show on Thursday night so we can catch up with you then and talk a little bit about economics as long as we still believe
that. Well, I have a group of students here from USM, and I think they'd all like to say hello to Pat LaMarche. So can we sign off with them all saying hi to you?
Please do.
Hello, Pat.
Hello.
My name is Mark Bean. I'm a political science major at USM.
Keep up the good fight, Mark. I'm Pat LaMarche, filled in for Rick Smith. Thanks an awful lot. Sorry, we got to go.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. At least 9.5 million more Americans have health insurance coverage thanks to the Affordable Care Act, according to state and federal reports and surveys. 6 million have signed up for insurance under the Health Care Reform Act's state exchanges. More specific numbers will be available in coming months, but the picture emerging is that the health care reform known as Obamacare has created the largest expansion of health insurance coverage to uninsured Americans in 50 years. According to reporting in the Los Angeles Times, survey data and reports from insurance companies show there's been no net reduction in coverage from policy cancellations, despite claims from some Republicans that cancellations last fall would lead to a net reduction in coverage. The health care reform has made a sizable dent in the total number of uninsured Americans, according to polls from Gallup and from RAND.
AFSCME District 48 in Milwaukee is suing Milwaukee County in federal court on behalf of janitors laid off by Governor Scott Walker when he was Milwaukee County Executive. The suit alleges violation of the workers' constitutional right to free association under the First Amendment. The workers charged that after they were laid off in 2009, Milwaukee County refused to call them back, rehire them, or provide them with references because of their association with AFSCME District 48. AFSCME District 48's Boyd McCamish.
Scott Walker purposely intended to harm folks for the union affiliation. That's a violation of the law. And number two, conveniently, the company that took over the work was a major Scott Walker during that time and still is to this day. So we feel that the custodial workers at the courthouse, their civil rights have been violated. They were essentially penalized for political and union affiliation, and that is a violation of the law.
AFSCME says that the county was acting on recommendations from Walker. Walker privatized Milwaukee County janitorial services, giving the work to a company owned by a Walker campaign contributor. One email among the many thousands recently released from the first John Doe criminal probe into Walker's Milwaukee County executive days has Walker's then chief of staff saying that Walker should punish AFSCME members, urging Walker to, quote, furlough the hell out of them and find the most senior members and, quote, burn them a new one. A minimum wage increase signed into law in Connecticut on Thursday will raise the state minimum to $10.10 an hour by 2017. It's the first state in the nation to enact that minimum wage. But for working people waiting for it, it increases very slowly to $9.15 an hour in 2015, $9.60 by 2016, and then to $10.10 in 2017. In Connecticut, between 70,000 and 90,000 people earn the minimum wage. The U.S. Labor Department says nationally about 5% of all hourly workers are paid at or below the federal minimum of $7.25 an hour.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
There is no other agency like the EPA. It should really be renamed the Job-Killing Organization of America.
Because, brothers, it's fact. If we take and don't put back, they'll have to pay for all we did. So let's leave some blue above us. Let's leave some green.
You know, when it comes to preserving the environment, there's nothing more important in the whole world than making sure that the feminine gender of the species is preserved and protected. And by that, I don't mean locked in a cage, given a bunch of hang-ups, and tortured with obsessing about sexuality at the age of nine. I mean, we need to protect our daughters, our sisters, our mothers, ourselves. And we need to make sure that we have a safe and healthy environment for young women and grown women and old women to live with dignity and respect. And over the last couple of weeks, the story of the Purity Ball has really, grabbed the public's attention. ABC News sent a crew in to one of these Purity Balls and did a story about, what it is it's a dance that's thrown for young girls where they pledge their purity to their fathers. I couldn't make this up, and if I could make this up, I'd shoot me. They pledge their purity to their fathers. They get a little wedding band. They promise not even to kiss somebody until they get married. They quite frankly are taught that everything about themselves that's natural and healthy and a regular human desire is quite wrong. And if they should give in to any of those desires, that they will be wrong. And so their pledge will be broken. Their father's heart will be broken. Blah, 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 blah. Now, you read about this and you hear about these purity balls, and these girls are in elegant gowns, and it's so fancy, and, you know, their $100 plate dinners in country clubs, and you're thinking, okay, so there are maybe a couple of thousand really crazy people out there doing this to their very rich daughters. But it's not that way. It is endemic throughout society in a group of people who, whether they're dirt poor or filthy rich, are obsessing about their daughters and what they're going to do or not do as they become women. And then that's what leads us to the bullcrap in Texas with with laws that restrict a woman's right to choose. So now they have to, in order to use their right to choose, they have to go to a hospital, closing clinics all over the place in Texas, and no birth control in the Affordable Care Act, and blah, 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 this control of women. So I was talking about this last week, and much to my own surprise, I was approached by two wonderful women that I love and respect greatly who grew up this way, who weren't silver spoon in their mouth, rich kids in sterling silver shoes and emerald evening gowns. These are just everyday little girls who were brought up having, well, they agreed to be on the show, so I don't have to tell you how they were brought up. They're going to tell you. My first guest tonight, Kristen Kapp. Kristen, thank you for taking the time tonight to share your story.
Thank you. Good evening.
Yeah, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. Hey, so Kristen, I've known you for a very long time, basically, in my opinion, since you were a girl. You just turned 19 when I met you, so you had just become a young woman in the fact that you could vote, but they still didn't think you were, you know, capable of picking out whether or not you had a beer. That was still denied to you by the state. And I knew that you were a very religious person, but I didn't know how deep that went in your upbringing about your own sexuality and privacy as a little girl. So, excuse me. Why don't you give us a quick rundown on what it was like to be a little kid in your very religious home?
It was very much about rules and learning to live by the book so that you wouldn't anger an angry God.
Mm. So this is in everything, like, you don't slam the door if your mother tells you not to slam because that's disobeying your parents. This
and
is every
God.
Yeah, every rule.
Every rule. Every rule. From not slamming the door to doing your homework properly. If the homework wasn't perfect, if it wasn't the penmanship wasn't great, it would be torn up. And I would be told that you're not doing your best as unto the Lord.
Huh.
Do it again.
Wow. So you're like damning your immortal soul instead of just screwing up 5 plus 4.
Exactly.
Did that seem normal? Did your inner psyche rebel, or were you just devoted to trying?
Oh no, that was the way it was. That was just the way it was. You did not deviate because, you know, I wanted God to love me.
Yeah.
I wanted my parents to love me, and I wanted to do what was right because I wanted to go to heaven.
Was not being loved part of the penalty in your mind?
Oh, not just in my mind. That was the reality, especially when it came to anything sexual. From the time I was, you know, old enough to know what the word sex was, I think about 10, my father would say, I won't have any whores or sluts in my house.
Wow, did you learn whore and slut the same day you learned sex?
I did, actually, and that was the same day that I learned that my cousin got pregnant as a teenager. And
was she brought up the same way?
I don't think to the extent that I was.
Yeah.
We were driving home up I-75, crossing the Ohio River into Cincinnati, and I remember, and I will never forget this conversation, of my parents talking about my cousin getting pregnant, and my father said to me, you had better never let that happen to you. You get pregnant or have sex before you're married, and you will be out of my house so fast your head will spin.
Do you think he meant it? Do you think he was trying to scare you and he would have forgiven you, or do you think he meant it?
Absolutely not. He meant it. He meant it. He never said things he didn't mean. He meant it.
Wow. You know, I have a couple of kids. I can't think of telling them anything that would make me shun them. But I wasn't brought up like your dad. Was he brought up?
That was the ultimate sin.
The ultimate sin was, you mean more than murder?
Oh, that wasn't even an option. That was so far-fetched.
So it wasn't.
That
they didn't
wasn't
fear that you would.
The
yeah, they didn't fear that you'd come home and say, "Hey, I killed somebody." They did fear that you'd come home and say, "You're going to be a grandfather." So at 10, you get this, don't be a slut, you know, and I got to tell you, I got to take a minute right now and say that a woman or a young woman or a girl, depending on how you want to describe a person who's old enough to engage in sexual congress of any kind, does not deserve any other human being judging them. And,
oh, you're absolutely right.
And the words that are used, these words that are used, are whether by a man or a woman to discuss a young person, just they just make me crazy. Or a 50-year-old slut, right? Anybody, I find it so egregious that anyone would judge somebody else and label them based on what they choose to do with their own body, which is none of somebody else's business. I will say, though,
precisely,
of girls between 11 and 13 who get pregnant, they are almost always impregnated by someone over 19. So it's
exactly.
It's predatory. There's a predator out there that has preyed on that 12-year-old girl, and that isn't a choice she's making. But that's aside.
You're absolutely right.
Okay, so you're 10, you're getting the Riot Act, you go to school the next day or a week later, and a boy talks to you nicely. Are you afraid of him?
Terrified. Absolutely terrified. I wouldn't talk to boys. One boy, his name was Mike, and he was wonderful. I was very interested in him.
Meaning you think he was cute? You're a 10-year-old girl.
Oh,
you think
I thought
he
was adorable.
Yeah.
I thought he was adorable. And I wanted him to come over to my house. And my parents had a rule that no one could come over to the house without getting prior permission, which is understandable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe my parents had something going on that day. But I asked my father, can Mike come over today? And he said, there will be no boys in this house. Mike didn't come over.
Yeah. And had you kind of along the line sort of been chummy with Mike, and then all of a sudden you had to say, Mike, you can never come over my house?
Exactly.
And was this boy also religious?
Yes.
Did he understand that he was dirty and probably going to rape you?
No. He was not religious to the same extent. He was a different type of religious than me.
Now you have a little brother.
Yes.
Was your little brother given this sort of frightening lecture at 10 or 9 or 11?
Oh, no. Not at all. Not at all. He's a boy.
He wasn't said, if you get a girl pregnant, we are going to disown you?
Oh, absolutely not. On the contrary, when he was about 15, right before our dad passed away, he passed away when Gilbert was very young, and one of the things that he said to my brother then was, you know, when are you ever going to get a girlfriend?
Huh. But they did not want you.
I was never allowed to date in high school, ever. It was expressly forbidden.
And your brother
was
15.
My father always used to say, my father used to say, you know, if you bring a boy around here, I have two rifles.
Wow.
And it effectively scared me away from ever having a boyfriend. I never, ever dated in high school. I never kissed anyone. I never went to any school dances. I didn't go to prom because, you know, that's where people get pregnant.
Okay, so you're
a
little,
you've
got total, for want of a better term, your development as a young woman who's gonna, you know, learn interpersonal dynamics with people of the opposite sex is completely arrested.
Oh, absolutely.
And so you can talk to men who are what, married men or preachers or, but peer group boys, you can't even have.
Authority figures were absolutely fine.
Wow.
But I learned very early on as well that my peers were the least of my problems.
Right. Now, you shared with me recently that you believe that because of this upbringing, because of the only people that you were allowed to be around being these authority figures, that actually caused you pain, suffering, and to be a victim.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, 16 years ago today, I was raped by a teacher who I trusted, who I was told, I was always told to believe that adult teachers especially were the authority and that they were not to be questioned, that they were, that I was to submit to their authority and be humble and be compliant. And I think that my upbringing did not even begin to prepare me to talk to my parents about any kind of sexual behavior, let alone know how to resist when I didn't want to be a willing participant. This person who I had trusted, who taught me wonderful things in the Cincinnati Public Library about authors and books and taking me out of myself and in branching my imagination into places I hadn't been before, he was the same person who took me behind the book stacks and raped me.
Was this something that you could tell your parents?
Absolutely not. To this day, my mother doesn't know.
And we hope she's not listening.
She's not listening.
Yeah.
This is the first time I've ever spoken publicly about this, ever.
And I really appreciate that you're doing this. And I can only hope, although I just think that nothing ever makes a difference anymore and becomes so cynical, but I can only hope that somebody out there who's really trying to, quote-unquote, shelter their child, trying to teach them to just know nothing about anything and to reject everything, will listen to you and realize that children need to know, they need to have options, they need to know that they can come to you, they need to know that they can tell you anything, and they need to know that you will support them, especially if they have to tell a teacher, I am verily sorry, but I'm going home and telling my mom on you, and you better never touch me again, long before it gets to the point of rape.
Right. You're absolutely right. But I don't see that happening unless we can change the way that the church thinks about women and about their bodies.
You have since changed churches. You are no longer of the faith that you were in.
You are absolutely correct.
The fundamental faith that you were in. Was that a difficult change? I mean, did you say one day, you know, these things that were taught were wrong, and I need to find a church that teaches me something I find meaningful?
It was the single hardest thing I've ever done in my entire life. When I made the decision to leave the church that I was literally born into, I was born into a hospital that was run by the church.
Huh.
I literally was born into this faith. For me to leave that, I was actually working full-time as an ordained minister in this church. So they were very progressive in that they would ordain women and allow women to hold ecclesiastical leadership roles. But they, in other ways, were so far removed from what my thinking had become that I could no longer... I found myself drifting. I still have a great appreciation for this church and a great love for what they do. And I'm not going to name them because I'm not mm-hmm. about dragging anyone's name through the mud. But when I say it was the hardest thing I've ever done, when I chose to change churches, I chose to give up my career, my housing, my vehicle, even the furniture in the house that I own, that I lived in was not mine. The pots, the pans, even the sheets on the bed did not belong to me. So to leave this life was to literally walk away from everything I knew. And in doing so, I knew that people that I considered to be close with me, that I considered to be my friends, I knew that a lot of them would no longer want to associate with me, and that I found that to be true. And honestly, by speaking with you tonight and being this honest in public about my opinions on things and where I stand in regard to women and their own sexuality and their own control of their bodies.
You're going to lose more friends.
Quite possibly put me, it'll quite possibly make me lose more friends that still speak with me.
Now, someone wrote to me that they're appalled by what they're hearing as, well, okay, that's a healthy response. They're appalled by what they're hearing, and they think most Christians would be appalled by what they're hearing. And
I don't think that's true at all. I think that most Christians, I think that as a group by and large, and mind you, let me make no mistake, I am still very much a Christian. I am still very much committed to Jesus. I am very much committed to my faith. I've just begun to see things a little differently. But I think that to start off with, that Christians don't talk about sexual behavior in open enough terms to even start to prepare women to speak openly to their potential partners about it, let alone know how to resist if she finds herself in a situation she doesn't want to be in. I think that the vast majority of Christians are still holding women to a double standard when it comes to men. You were talking about the purity balls,
mm-hmm.
and those are not. That is a new incarnation of an old idea. When I was 12 years old, our youth group, we were, you know, put into our 15 passenger church vans and driven to the Marriott Hotel in downtown Cincinnati, where we were going to have a youth rally and a big worship session. And they divided us off by gender, and we were given a true love weights talk. That was the big thing back when I was, young lady.
I'm sorry, true I just instantly weights. Thought true love weights like something you have to lift and carry. But you mean true love weights. It doesn't have sex. It doesn't kiss. It doesn't have anything to do with the opposite sex.
Exactly. Okay. There was a book back then called I Kissed Dating Goodbye. And we were all given a copy as we walked in the door. But I think you're right about thinking of it as a weight.
Huh.
Because as the day went on, this woman who was a high-up person in our church got up and told us an analogy. She gave us this analogy of all of us girls, we were all, our bodies are like wrapped lollipops. And when you have sex with a boy or a man, it's like he's unwrapping your lollipop and sucking on it. And it might feel great when it's happening, but when he's done with you, all you have left is this poorly wrapped saliva-fouled sucker. And I will never forget that phrase, a poorly wrapped saliva-fouled sucker.
Oh, my God.
That was told to me 9 months and 2 days after I'd been raped.
Wow.
And
how can you feel like you're anything but poorly wrapped then? Like, beyond my ability to say no, beyond my ability to, I'm given this authority figure who has, who dominates me and makes me submit, and then I am a poorly wrapped sucker.
Yes, and that is why these purity pledges hurt women, because it's almost exclusively young girls who are asked to take these oaths. It's almost never the boys, and it's never young men who are told that if they break this promise to stay a virgin, that they're going to be nothing but useless, used up, worthless pieces of trash.
Yeah. That's,
you know,
yeah, that's really the thing. You will, and that whole, you can tell women apart, the valuable ones from the unvaluable ones, by whether or not they've been sullied. You know,
precisely.
And I, you know, I've people are really like, I can't believe this is happening. How old is she? You're what, 33?
I'm 34.
34.
34.
But really, the reason Jerry Sandusky got away with it was because he had power. The reason that the priests got away with it was because they had power and, oh, respect, you know, and
yes,
their own church moved them around. I mean, people are incredulous and writing to me right now like Fast and Furious because they're horrified and they don't want to believe this is true of the church that they love, whatever that church
is. It is true. And there is a phrase going around that is trending among youth pastors right now, this minute, and it's called modest is hottest.
Yeah.
This is the new motto. When I was young, it was true love wait, and now it's modest is hottest. And it's only ever addressed to the girl. There's such a double standard. And I think that those three words, that modest is hottest, just carry so much baggage. And I think that the reason it's so effective and it's taken such hold in our youth culture in the church today is because it's rooted in shame. And shame is a really powerful motivator.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, it shamed me into not saying anything for 16 years.
Yeah.
You know, it was 16 years before I ever told anyone what had happened to me. And what else concerns me about this purity ball and modest is hottest kind of approach to young women is that it perpetuates the objectification of us, but it just wraps it in this pious form. You know, it's saying, you know, women's bodies are not actually, not really. We're going to say that you're made in the image of God, but you're not really a reflection of the image of God. You're a source of temptation that has to be hidden. You know, it's the other side of that same objectification coin that says that, you know, we're going to exploit the female body, and in the church, we seem to be so ashamed of it. You know, and all this negative talk about our bodies and what we are as women has left this vacuum for these purity balls and these pledges and modest is hottest. It fills that void, you know?
Mm-hmm. I talked to a young Muslim boy in Egypt one time. He was a boy. He was 18 or 19. He was a young man. And he said that women have to be covered because they're irresistible, that they have to cover women because they're irresistible and it's best that they don't look at them. It's best that, you know, if you get a pizza, if you're in Cairo and you get a pizza, the delivery guy knocks on the door and then walks down the hall in case a woman should answer the door so that you can't look at her. I mean, this when we hear about it happening in a Muslim community, we're like, oh, that's crazy. And we don't admit that it happens in the United States or in Christian communities or that...
Oh, it absolutely does.
Or that this evangelicalism or fundamentalism, that no matter what religion it's in, is making, you know, we're letting men get away with the fact that they can't stop themselves if a woman is too attractive.
Right. And I think that as long as we keep sending that message to our boys, that it's the responsibility of women to make sure that the men aren't exposed to something sexually stimulating, I think that as long as we keep perpetuating that, it's going to not only damage our men into thinking, you know, that they are not responsible for how they think or act or, I don't know, fantasize, it's entirely unfair to women. Nobody else is responsible for them.
Yeah.
We can't blame women for the way men are wired.
And there's, by the way, there's nothing wrong with wanting sex. There's nothing wrong,
sure.
You know, and so to make the whole thing, it's not like you're fantasizing about cutting someone's throat, you know?
Precisely.
I'm beyond out of time. Greg from South Carolina has just sent us, I'm going to put all this stuff up on the Facebook page, but he just sent an article about the abstinence education lobby. This just isn't in religion. It's religion's control of government, and now it's in government. So,
is complete garbage. It's complete garbage.
Kristen, I don't even want to thank you for sharing your story because it makes my heart so sad that you have a story like that to share. But, you know, your courage and anybody who's not your friend after tonight really wasn't a friend. You know?
Well, let me just say, as my final opinion on this entire thing, is that covering and shaming women is not the solution we need. As a church, as Christians, we have to overhaul our own theology surrounding our virginity. You know, women are still associated with their virginity in ways that men aren't. And because of that, our identities are tied to our bodies in ways that men aren't. Mm. And as a 34-year-old woman who's never been on a date and never been kissed and never willingly had sex, I'm still reaping the consequences of that upbringing. And I would just, if you are a Christian and you are listening to this and you have daughters, please learn from what I've said.
Kristen, thank you so much. Kristen Kapp.
You're very welcome.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk to Corey. Corey has a similar story to Kristen's, just in case you think that it only happened once. I'm Pat Lamar, filling in for Rick Smith. This is the Rick Smith Show. We'll be right back.
Changing America for the better.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm John Kerr. In the final days of Obamacare's open enrollment period, Fox News aired a deceptive chart suggesting that the Obama administration would fall far short of the initial Obamacare enrollment estimate of 7 million. On All In with Chris Hayes, guest host Steve Kornacki denounced Fox for airing the misleading chart.
And Fox News resorted to making graphics that try to portray 6 million enrollees as actually only about a third of the enrollment goal of 7 million. Check that out.
After receiving widespread criticism calling them out on the chart, Fox co-host Bill Hemmer corrected the chart on Fox's America's Newsroom.
Programming note here yesterday about this time, you might have seen a graphic on the Obamacare sign-up numbers. Here is what that graphic should have looked like. On the left, it shows the 6 million sign-ups reported for the administration as of March 27, compared to the target number of 7 million plus. That was our mistake. Correction noted.
That wasn't an April Fool's joke. Fox actually corrected the error. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We've been talking about World War II military photographer Bill Jones and the most famous photos he ever snapped. Jones wanted to be a pilot, but he was underweight. So instead of flying in the cockpit, he trained in aerial photography. When the war ended, he was on furlough. But for Bill Jones, wartime service was not yet finished. He was ordered to Japan at the end of 1945. He'd been selected as the official U.S. Army photographer to establish visual documentation of the damage done by the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Jones recorded the devastation in January 1946. He was a 20-year-old corporal. According to interviews, the officers along on the mission felt a different level of energy than any of their wartime missions. There was a special sense of history and curiosity. But join us again for Mr. Jones's movie. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Where's Charles Dickens when we need him? the novelist who laid bare the shame of gross income inequality in 19th century England, came up with some perfectly fitting names for his Fat Cat characters, including Scrooge, Mr. Tulkinghorn, Miss Havisham, and Nickleby. So I'm wondering what moniker Dickens would have given to Robert Marcus. He's the CEO of Time Warner Cable, who has just won gold in the Greed Olympics for grabbing the most gold with the least effort in the shortest time. Marcus became chief of the cable company on January 1st, and he immediately reached out to his corporation's biggest rival, Comcast, offering to sell Time Warner to that giant. Only 6 weeks later, the deal was done. Why would a CEO rush to eliminate both his corporation and his own job? Perhaps because of a lucrative little provision in the contract he signed to become Time Warner's honcho. It's a CCC, a change of control clause. This is yet another way for CEOs to feather their own nest, for a CCC hands a big golden parachute to the top executive of a corporation that gets sold. In this case, Robert pockets $80 million. Yes, that's roughly $1.8 million a day for each of about 45 days he worked to sell the company. What we have here is a perverse form of incentive pay for corporate chieftains. Rather than rewarding them for outcompeting their rivals, a CCC encourages them to sidle up to their competitors and whisper, "Psst, want to buy my corporation?" This is Jim Hightower saying, not only did Marcus sell off Time Warner, but his self-serving deal will also sell out untold numbers of its employees who will be made redundant by the merger. We hear about America's widening gap in income inequality, but here we can actually see it widen. One rich man gains an extra $80 million, and hundreds of workers lose their income.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Call me the American
Yeah, I think we might just be talking about the American Nightmare tonight. This is Pat LaMarche. I'm filling in for Rick Smith. Rick's got the night off. We are very excited about our trip to Pittsburgh. Next week we're going to be hanging out with the AFL-CIO. We're going to do all kinds of great interviews. You're not going to want to miss out. And check it out, Pittsburgh. I love that place. This is a pretty heavy show, and if you're still with us, I'm really proud of you because it's really some tragic reality we're dealing with. And, oh, by the way, it's avoidable. We don't have to raise our daughters this way. We don't have to treat them this way. We certainly don't have to make them feel like they – let's face it. Maybe part of the big scheme is to treat women this way. Of the 10 worst-paying jobs in the country in the last 5 years, 75% of them have been filled by women. Maybe we do need people with destroyed self-esteem in the slave class, reproducing in absolute poverty – and never feeling like they're going to be able to make anything out of themselves. And maybe the way to do that is to make themselves feel dirty and nasty and awful if they do anything that strays from their controlling families or churches or whatever. I don't know. You know, because this is so crazy to me, I don't know why it makes sense. Joining me right now is Corey. Corey, you are, we're talking about purity balls. We're talking about the young girls who are brought up to believe that they are pledging their virtue to their dad and they're going to be, straight to heaven if they manage to keep everybody away from the, didn't somebody say in the last presidential election that all a woman needed for birth control was an aspirin between her knees? I mean, people who think this isn't still going on out there, you know, have not been paying attention. But, Corey, you grew up in a family like this, too.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about what it was like for you as a little girl. And at what age did people start talking to you about the dirty reality of dirty girl sex?
Well, I think, so my mom started talking to me about, like, the mechanics of sex pretty early on. And I think, mostly because, I have an older sister who's, like a decade older than me. And there had been you know, a history of, like, molestation in our family, and I think my mom was very concerned about that. So we, like, grew up knowing, like, the appropriate names for all of our body parts, and, like, my mom talked with us frequently about those things, and, like, in that sense, compared to, like, the other kids that I was growing up with, you know, my family was, like, cuckoo and, like, liberal or whatever, because, you know, we talked very openly about those things. But as far as rules were concerned, definitely, like, fell in line with that sort of system. And when I was really young, it didn't really seem to affect me that much at all. I mean, I had, like, a ring and stuff that my dad gave me, but, like, and there were dances and stuff that you could go to, but I didn't really go to them because this might surprise you, Pat, but I was not a very feminine child.
Oh, you're so feminine. So, now you're delicate, for God's sake. You are. You're beautiful.
So I wasn't really, like, interested in that sort of stuff. I,
so
like,
wait
had
a minute,
a really
though.
Great time.
Was it a big deal when you got the ring? I mean, what was that?
My dad took me to dinner at Outback, and we got appetizers. You know, it was a big deal.
Wow, when you get appetizers, you know it's a special dinner.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was, like, it was really super fun. And, like, it made me, like, I think what it was supposed to do was make me, like, have expectations or something like that. Like, I was supposed to expect a man to treat me a certain way.
And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with saying you need to be treated a certain way. No one should treat you like
absolutely.
Crap, male or female.
Absolutely. Yeah. But at the time, like, I didn't really care. I just was excited to go to dinner with my dad, and he gave me this cool piece of jewelry, and I wore it because he gave it to me, and I was excited about that. It wasn't until, like, several years later when I actually, like, you know, had friends that were boys that things started to become problematic, because that had never been a problem before. All of my best friends were boys. It was never a problem. And then suddenly it's like, I'm 16 years old, and now none of my friends will talk to me anymore. And, you know, I can't go do anything with them anymore because I'm not allowed to ride in a car with them. And that sort of, like, I sort of adjusted to that.
Let me back up. How old were you when you got the ring?
I think it was, like, maybe 11 or 12.
Wow. And
Something like that.
Yeah, was there ever a point where you were told, this ring means that I'm in charge of your virtue and you don't have sex with anybody until you're married? Did you get that lecture?
Yeah. Yeah, it was basically like you're married to me until I say you're married to somebody else. It was basically sort of the gist
Wow.
of everything.
Now here's a chicken wing.
Yeah. And there definitely was, like, the conversation about it, and I think at the time I didn't really take it too seriously because there wasn't any situation that I was like, no problem, boys are gross.
Yeah.
I don't care.
Yeah.
Like, but then, you know, then it started to affect my life more immediately as I got a little bit older. And so I ended up, I was a musician as a young person, and I ended up playing in bands and stuff like that. And I was in youth group band, and I was in praise band at church and all that stuff. And so I ended up in a band with a couple of guys. One of the guys is married, so that was all cool. And the other guy was, you know, a year older than me, and he was like my best friend, you know. And we hung out a lot, and we spent a lot of time together. And, you know, since I didn't have any, neither of us had any other experience with, you know, personal relationships of any kind, so it was kind of like we were in love or whatever,
Like
to our own understanding at that point in our lives, you know. This is basically, we were like 19 and 20 years old and experiencing the relationship that you have when you're like 9 years old and you fall in love with like the boy that like throws dirt at you on the playground. Like,
Right. That's
the situation that was happening, but so much later in life. And my parents found out about it and they were pretty mad. And so they said that we had to get married or we couldn't see each other anymore. So we got married.
Wow. So,
yeah.
So you're basically a grown woman, 19 or 20.
Yeah, I was 19. Yeah.
And you're in your first relationship with a boy. Was it sexual when your parents made you get married?
No, well, I mean, we bent the rules, but we didn't break them. So, yeah. Like, you know, we hugged
had,
and stuff.
Yeah, and kissed. You kissed?
Yeah.
Okay.
We had kissed a couple times, but it wasn't like,
wow.
that was very, those were moments of extreme weakness.
Wow. And so you,
yeah.
You really kept the pledge.
Yeah, yeah. No, we both were very serious about it, and both of us had been sort of like, you know, we were both leaders in the youth group at church. You know, it was very, we both of us had these, like, sort of, like, pedestals that we were on as far as, like, our virtue. Like, we were both considered very virtuous people, and I think that's probably why it was kind of, like, important for us to, like, do something to legitimize this sort of closeness that people could see happening between the two of us.
So what you were doing is, as a person who doesn't know, because you weren't allowed to date, you weren't allowed to get to know boys, you weren't allowed to do any of this, you're building a friendship that's really close and solid with this other person, and you're both finding each other, if you're kissing, you're finding each other attractive, and you're liking each other. And so because this is now the point where a man and a woman have to either get married or stop knowing each other,
right.
Which blows my mind, and I'm having trouble saying. you are scolded into marrying, and you marry this man who you care a great deal about, but you don't know anything about yourself sexually and your own sexuality because you have just never even wondered.
Right. And, I mean, we were married for 5 years. So, like, even after we got married, like a year after we were married, the two of us maintained that we never would have gotten married as early as we did if we had had the opportunity to explore our relationship further without getting married. So, you know, like, if we had had a normal life where, like, two people meet, they are attracted to one another, they go on dates, they hang out, they do things, like, I think in the natural progression, I probably would have figured out, oh, you know what, I really like you, you're a really cool dude, but guess what, I'm totally gay.
Yeah.
And that probably would have happened, like, 10 years ago instead of only 5 years ago, you know?
So you're in a marriage for 5 years, and you've been restricted by all of this, I'm even taking it beyond religion because a lot of religions aren't like this. You're being controlled by this sort of, mind play, and you're not allowed to even think about your own sexuality, and then you're married to a man that you care a great deal about that you got married to without ever exploring really sexually, and you realize that you're a lesbian, and now you're trapped, married to a nice person that you never wanted to hurt.
Absolutely. That's such a perfect way to put it. Is that's exactly how I felt, was trapped for a while. And you know, thank God, you know my mom, as many different, you know, my parents, I feel like they, as many mistakes as they made, I understand, I can see now where they were coming from. You know, my mom and dad had their first child when they were 16 and 17 years old. And then they were immediately apart for 10 years. And then they ended up reconciling their relationship and getting back together and then making a family and moving forward with their lives. But, you know, which is an amazing story, but,
right.
But there was so much heartbreak and hurt surrounding that. I understand sort of what they were trying to protect. I think they were trying to protect us from this giant mistake that they felt that they had made, even though it had become so rewarding for them. I mean, my older sister was just this amazing, amazing person. So, like, I never feel like they regretted having a child. I think they just remember all of that hurt and pain that they went through for, like, a huge portion of their lives. And they were trying to spare us from that, and that was a big part of, like, buying into this philosophy.
Yeah.
Excuse me, this philosophy of puritiness and all of this stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And, but in the long run, my mom was like, you're depressed, like, go to a therapist. And I did, and that was a big part of me being able to, be able to separate and disengage from the relationship that I was in and become the person that I am now.
So you've got the now this is another thing that I've always found fascinating about people, and it's probably Stockholm syndrome or something after a while. You know, the people who had, like your parents, desire and loved each other and had sex and had a baby, thinking they can turn around and convince their children that they won't feel desire, they won't want a baby, that they can convince them sex is bad, you know?
Yeah.
And the number of people who honestly believe sex is bad, you know, hate is bad, you know? Making your children feel inadequate or naughty or dirty when they're just human, that's bad. But sex is wonderful. And, you know, so all of these gears grinding in people who, you know, you're like, wait a minute, you were 17, you know?
Yeah.
And so that part's always amazing to me. But, okay, so your marriage is built on a whole pile of stuff like somebody else's rules. You learn from therapy and trusting yourself that you're a lesbian. How did your parents take that?
I honestly think they were a little bit more upset about me getting divorced than anything else.
Yeah.
At first it was really hard. I mean, my sister, I'm very close to my younger sister, and, I'd been talking with her through this whole process, and one day I was just like so upset, so distraught on the phone with her, and she was like, listen to me. She was like, pack all of your things. In 1 week from today, I'm coming there and I'm picking you up. Have everything packed and be ready to go. And, sure enough, 1 week from that day, she showed up at my house and, she rented a car. And she put all my stuff and my dog and me in the car, and we drove back to Texas. And I lived with her for about four or five months. And during that time, before that time, I had had conversations with my husband at the time about what I was feeling and what I was going through. And I told him that I thought I was gay, and he didn't believe me. And you know, I told him that I wanted to be separated, that I thought we needed some time to figure things out. And he was definitely hurt, of course, as anyone would be. But, you know, he kind of let me go. And, you know, during the time that I was gone in Texas, I was, you know, I told him how I felt we needed to, you know, disengage from our relationship. And, I came out to my parents, and my mom wrote me a letter, and she told me that she still loved me, and that even if I was a murderer, she would visit me in jail.
Gay or a murderer, I'd still love you.
yeah. So essentially, like, being gay is just like being a murderer. Mm. But my dad didn't speak to me, but I had this immediate outpouring from some members of my extended family. I mean, before I even left, my cousin Andrew and his wife drove up from Orlando, and they're like, what's going on? What can we do? And, you know, I told them everything, and they were super supportive. And his mom, Andrea, my mother's, you know, older sister, also lived in Texas, and she called me, and she was like, what's going on? Let me help you. And very supportive. And, so I, at the same moment of like losing everything, I was like, gaining this outpouring of support from several members of my family. And I just sort of let it just come to me. I didn't really like seek out any of that stuff. But I stayed there for a few months and sort of let things calm down. And then I moved back to Gainesville because Casey was there.
Casey being your beautiful, wonderful fiance, because you live in a state where you can get married. Hallelujah.
Well, we can't get married. We can get civilly unioned, but we can't get married. We're crossing our fingers that maybe by October it might happen, but.
That's too bad. Have you two thought, moving into the world where people aren't being messed up anymore and where they've recovered from this stuff, if you were married in a different state, would Colorado recognize it?
Yes.
Ah.
Yeah.
So we can have a civil union in Colorado, but if we had a marriage in another state, they would recognize it.
Well, maybe that would be fun. Go on vacation to Maine or something and get married, and then.
Who knows? It might happen.
Yeah, that would be great. But, you know, I mean, for anyone who's been married as many times as I have, it's not even fair that I have a conversation or an opinion about the whole thing. But when I look at you two, which I love to do because you're both so wonderful, but when I look at you two, I just see such happiness, you know, and such love. And, you know, I want it not to matter, you know? I want it not to matter if you're married or not, and I want it not to matter if you're in a civil union or not, but it does matter. It matters to the people who want it. And that's what's such that's what's such a shame about all these stupid rules.
It's true.
It's just more rules beaten on you.
It's true. I mean, it's like you said, it only matters when other people. It matters to other people, you know, like it only to us. You're right. Like it doesn't, the piece of paper isn't really what's important. What's important is that we get the same, we get recognized as being, you know, legitimate partners, you know, like in situations where we're, you know, if one of us was ill or if in the future we have children, you know, those are the situations where legally it's important, but.
Well, and the title of wife just has so much more respect than girlfriend. You know, I mean, you're like, oh, wow, that's
we're going to use that term.
Yeah, that's a real relationship. But, oh, well, all right. You can use whatever term you want. So one last question. We got about 2 minutes left. How does your family feel about this civil union? Or, I mean, are they glad you're...
I think that both my parents, I think, could see that I'm happier.
Mm-hmm.
My mother is a lot more supportive. She's come a long way in the past 4 years. And I think she's grown a lot, in her understanding of religion and her ideals. And I think her belief systems have evolved quite a lot. However, I doubt I'll be surprised if either of them are at our wedding.
Really?
Mostly just because my dad has said that he won't come, and my concern is that he'll ask my mom not to come. If he asks her not to come, she won't. That's just, you know, her being respectful of his wishes. But I don't know. She'll probably come, but I don't expect to see my dad at all. But, I mean, you know, it's just this...
But I'm sorry about that. From the guy who did the hors d'oeuvres, you know, and the, you know, to the guy who, and it's still about religion?
For my dad, definitely. And I think that goes back really far for him as far as, like, how he uses religion to give himself a sort of framework to operate in and like sort of a system of control for his own life.
Yeah.
And then I think that just like sort of like flows on to the rest of the people in his life. You know, I think he loves my mother so much that when she's now, I'm like surprised. She's a completely different person than she was when I was growing up, you know, but I think because he loves her so much, he's like, you know, he lets her be her own person and do her own thing and has her own ideas about things. But, you know, she explicitly does not bring up these kinds of controversial conversations with him, you know.
Yeah, Corey, we're out of time. I know one thing. I'm awful glad you're going to be in my family. You already are in my family. This is Pal
Radio, WIOO Carlisle and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. At least 9.5 million more Americans have health insurance coverage thanks to the Affordable Care Act, according to state and federal reports and surveys. 6 million have signed up for insurance under the Health Care Reform Act's state exchanges. More specific numbers will be available in coming months, but the picture emerging is that the health care reform known as Obamacare has created the largest expansion of health insurance coverage to uninsured Americans in 50 years. According to reporting in the Los Angeles Times,
survey data and reports from insurance companies show there's been no net reduction in coverage from policy cancellations, despite claims from some Republicans that cancellations last fall would lead to a net reduction in coverage. The health care reform has made a sizable dent in the total number of uninsured Americans, according to polls from Gallup and from RAND. AFSCME District 48 in Milwaukee is suing Milwaukee County in federal court on behalf of janitors laid off by Governor Scott Walker when he was Milwaukee County Executive. The suit alleges violation of the workers' constitutional right to free association under the First Amendment. The workers charged that after they were laid off in 2009, Milwaukee County refused to call them back, rehire them, or provide them with references because of their association with AFSCME District 48. AFSCME District 48's Boyd McCamish.
Scott Walker purposely intended to harm folks for their union affiliation. That's a violation of the law. And number two, conveniently, the company that took over the work was a major campaign contributor to Scott Walker during that time and still is to this day. So we feel that the custodial workers at the courthouse, their civil rights have been violated. They were essentially penalized for political and union affiliation, and that is a violation of the law.
Absolutely. He says that the county was acting on recommendations from Walker. Walker privatized Milwaukee County janitorial services, giving the work to a company owned by a Walker campaign contributor. One email among the many thousands recently released from the first John Doe criminal probe into Walker's Milwaukee County executive days has Walker's then chief of staff saying that Walker should punish AFSCME members, urging Walker to, quote, furlough the hell out of them and find the most senior members and, quote, burn them a new one. A minimum wage increase signed into law in Connecticut on Thursday will raise the state minimum to $10.10 an hour by 2017. It's the first state in the nation to enact that minimum wage. But for working people waiting for it, it increases very slowly to $9.15 an hour in 2015, $9.60 by 2016, and then to $10.10 in 2017. In Connecticut, between 70,000 and 90,000 people earn the minimum wage. The U.S. Labor Department says nationally about 5% of all hourly workers are paid at or below the federal minimum of $7.25 an hour.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get paid too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again, because God is a Republican.
Folks to have an opportunity to understand the nature of the content of said crap.
It's all fresh in your mind, and you're feeling it, so you can get it out easier.
Okay, yeah, and I was a little bit frustrated because there was so little time last night. Sure.
It was worth it.
I had pages. I had pages of notes. because
well, you did a great job. You did a great job on that, and I wish there was a better way or a more articulate way that we could show what the problems are and how we can actually address them. And this is not. I don't blame the psychopaths, because that they were brought up to be make as much as you can, no matter what. If people die, they're expendable population. It's collateral damage. All these words start to come out. And they call the poor people the useless eaters. And I totally disagree with that. I just think the people sitting in front of a desk making money with stocks and pushing paper and not moving a damn thing forward, those are the true useless eaters. The guy who's sweeping the floor and digging the ditch and trying to take care of their family, because these people have pairs. But the person who's working, they are the true people. But the people who are pushing that paper, they are the true useless eaters. But unfortunately, if we think we should shoot them or get rid of them, we become just as bad as they are. So we need to have a different tact. And I wish you'd figure out a way. Sorry,
Well, no. That's I understand all of that, and you know, again, I'm grateful. I'm grateful to MSNBC for having the courage to cover this, because Steve Kornacki made Blankenship sit there and take it. Because and for those who don't understand this part of how it works, he wasn't there because MSNBC had this great idea and say, hey, let's bring on Don Blankenship. Don Blankenship's movie is now being pitched to media outlets all over the United States. So he's going and he's hustling it. I'm not kidding when I say that this should have been titled Don Blankenship and the quest for a reasonable doubt, or the quest for an alibi. This actually is, I think, part of a litigation strategy. This is about fouling, among other things, fouling the jury pool. Okay?
Oh, sure. No, I mean, I know very intelligent people. I mean, really, these are smart. These PhDs, they were one time really right aboard. They're no longer aboard it's probably global warming or climate change, because it's cyclical. I mean, this is outrageous to hear these intelligent people say, oh, wait, where are you coming from? No, I think it's cyclical. Now, these are left wingers, by the way. But I've said, so now, and this is why I don't even talk about climate change with this. I talk about just the economics about this. If the economics were taken out of the extractive industries, you would not see another mountaintop being blown off. You wouldn't see any more fracking. You would see nothing but renewables pop up throughout the world. You just take the profit out of this damn extractive industry, and you've won the game. Now, how do you want
to
do that?
You know, that's why West Virginia has a pitiful, pitifully low, and it took 100 years to get it, taxation rate, okay, maybe 75, maybe 60 years. The taxation rate on extracted coal. And if you say we're going to raise the tax rates, the coal industry says, oh, we'll just go out of business and leave. And the thing is, none of the politicians in this state ever have the courage to say, okay, go. Don't let the door hit you on the way out. You can't take the coal with you. It's still in the ground, and we know you want it.
Well,
but nobody ever does that.
As I'm saying,
I mean, but you raise another issue, Jeff. We need a carbon tax. We don't need some cap and trade scheme that can be traded by the same bunch of Wall Street banksters who crashed the economy with the housing bubble. We need a carbon tax.
Let me ask you about the carbon tax. I'm agreeing with you, but here's what I get when I say that. The answer to that to me is, if they give a carbon tax to the big guys, they're just going to pass the tax back on to the consumer. Now, it's hard for me.
But you can't pass the tax. I guess a little bit differently, Jeff. A carbon tax will create space in the market for renewables. And if the carbon tax on renewables is dramatically lower than the carbon tax on carbon, which it sort of rationally should be, then you can't pass the cost on to the consumers if the consumers can transition to renewables.
No, I understand that. But what I'm saying is, what I'm saying is that what we're trying to do when we put the carbon tax in is actually take the profit out of the extractive industry. And then make it so it's profitable or more profitable to do a renewable industry. Why not skip the middleman and just say, listen, this is just another shell game they're playing. And I understand.
Well, and by the way, I gotta throw this out there, Jeff, because, Mr. Gibson just pointed out in the chat room, I wish we could just get rid of fossil fuel subsidies altogether. So you get rid of the corporate welfare. Do they just pass on the absence of corporate welfare to the consumer as well?
Well, actually, that would work, because it would raise the price of fossil extractive industries so high they couldn't afford to sell it. They would go back to renewable energy.
But I also live in reality world, and I know. Let me just use one example I know that poverty communities are going to get hit harder by something like a carbon tax or the elimination of subsidies. They're going to get hit harder than, say, rural poverty communities. Because, for instance, the expansion of electric motor vehicles is really handy for around city driving. You can get most of what you need done in a city on an electric vehicle with a 70 mile charge. That same does not necessarily obtain out in rural America. So a plan that is really, really effective is going to say, how are we going to take the hit out of, and not just poor people in rural America, but poor people. If we think for the first time ever, Jeff, if we think about poor people first, then everything is gravy from there.
Don't get me onto that topic about, of course you think of poor people first. Well, forget poor people. How about people who are not poor? They're just victims of the same economic crap. They're not stupid. They're not poor. They're only poor because they were unlucky. I don't like we and they. How do we help all of humanity with a basic quality of life that fits? You just went right back to my bitch. Look, you could drive a battery op, right? In this town, people can't afford cars, believe it. The town of Florida I'm in, they can't afford to drive cars. So they live in a town which is very nice. It's not fancy. And they drive golf carts. And I've suggested that they put solar panels on the golf carts so they don't even have to plug them in. Now I've got a company coming in who's
in a place like Florida, that's crazy talk, Jeff.
Pardon me?
In a place like Florida, that's just crazy talk.
That's
solar panels.
And then they also ride bicycles around here. So those are two things that the people who have no money because of whatever reasons, it used to be a very profitable town. It's now, it's gone. I mean, it's horrendous what's happened to this town. But it's nice to see the kids driving, they're riding their bikes and golf carts and the mom and dad. They're proud people. They're poor. They don't have any money. But they're proud people, and they're not stupid. They understand about what's good. But they feel as though they have no power. They feel as though it doesn't matter. You've got the local politicians, millionaires, and they're keeping this town down. I mean, you've got a family in this town that owns half the county with ranches, but they don't want to see any change in this town. This is not just this town. It's every town in the United States. There's small little towns all over the place that this is happening. And you know that as well as I do.
Right. And that's what I was getting at. What do you do when a round trip to the grocery store is, 40 miles?
Well, that's it. You ready? We have a grocery store within this town. It was here 45 years. It went bust. Last year, we were able to get an IGA in here. After 2 years, I found a guy, and they were willing to, two brothers, and they went into the town, they rebuilt the old thing, and they started the IGA up. The young brother, for some reason, backed out. The older brother took a heart attack. The wife couldn't run it. We now don't have a grocery store in town. So that means the little small stores, the guy who owns the local Napa and the guy who owns the gas station put food in there and jacked the prices sky high, especially the beer, and that's what people drink around this town, unfortunately. And the closest
unfortunately, wash your mouth out.
18 miles.
Beer is liquid bread. Now quit it.
18 miles to the Walmart.
Yeah.
Or this is another small grocery. So they got to go 36 miles to get a decent price on their food. Now they're opening up. You're ready with their building in this town? A new school, which is real nice. They took away the trailers, and they started putting schools up. They're putting in an inland port, which is supposed to bring in 150,000 jobs. I'll believe that when I see it. They're putting in a brand-new Family Dollar, right next to the General Dollar, next to the Burger King. And they're also putting in a brand-new Salvation Army. Well, not Salvation Army, really. Goodwill.
Goodwill store, sure.
Now this is not – and then we have one Mexican restaurant, which is a good restaurant. Not fancy, but the food's good. People are honest. Great. What a time they had keeping that open because they didn't want to see any local stores come in like that. They had a great Hispanic area. They had a nice Cuban restaurant. And then
No. Now you're moving into food porn, Jeff. You just said Cuban restaurant. Oh my God. I'm starving. I'm sitting here starving.
Wait a second now. Anyway, but he had it closed because they offered him a very good job with the new prison we have. So the big thing in this town are prisons. That's what they have within 4 miles away. Now, it's a beautiful town. We have this beautiful walkway on the promenade. Well, the kids are, you know, and they kicked the hell out of the slats that, you know, there was a good looking little docks around. The kids got bored and they kicked the hell out of the slats. I mean, it's such a crime to see. We have a library, but they don't let people use the library to use the internet outside the library. They turn it off at night. Why don't you leave the internet on so people can do the library outside? They finally decided to do that. It's just a shame. This is not just here. This kind of thing goes all over this country. And if you have somebody who visits us from, let's say, Washington, D.C., and they look at this place and they say, my God, this is so poor. What are you, slumming? When we take them out to a local restaurant. I mean, I can't believe the mental attitude of a person who has, you know, who has some money within his family to come here and stick their nose up in the air. Like these people, how could you live here? I mean, this is insanity. This is, there's a major problem with our thinking process, Bob. That's the problem.
I'm not going to argue with you about that. I like to work in the concrete world. I mean, not concrete, but as opposed to getting too far off into the theoretical. And I like a sense of community.
Well, this has got it. By the way, my wife and I we took a walk down the park and we sat out and had a glass of wine this afternoon. It was so quiet and a couple of people went by with their bikes.
You know, I mean, if I was, you know, maximum dictator or whatever, I would insist that all new houses be built with broad front porches.
I agree with that.
To facilitate cooling of the house, but also to facilitate neighborliness.
Right, I agree.
If you're sitting on your porch instead of in your house in front of your TV, you know, oh my God, a beautiful Florida morning, a front porch, a rocking chair, a newspaper, and a good cup of coffee?
You got it. No, you got it. And what I found, when I used to camp when I was younger, a lot of camping. And the nice part about camping is you set up and you met your neighbors, people, you know, went over for a swim, they talk to one another. Now with the new campsites, these guys have these huge RVs with their TVs.
Well, that's not camping. That's not camping.
They don't go out. You know,
right. No.
I'm sorry. But don't you see, it's the mountaintop removal is horrendous. The fracking is horrendous. The way the extractive industries are just, it's brutal. The stock market's horrendous. There's not enough words to describe the despicability of it. I'm frustrated because I can't explain how badly things are, I've been on the chat room many times. I just can't get my machine to work. But when I go into the chat room, you got the people there, and they're all talking back and forth about it. You know, they're bright guy, bright group of people. The point is, it's very hard to keep on target to try to figure out.
Well, it's. I mean, look. I mean, the chat. What we've tried to create here. Yeah, I said I'm very into the idea of community. What we have tried to create here over the course of the last 10 years, Jeff, is exactly that. It is an online community. It's not beholden to AOL or Yahoo or any. It is an online community of like-minded people who enjoy being around each other and who, if they were ever to meet in person, because I've seen this happen time and time and time again, when they meet in person, it's like they've known each other for years. Because we have, and that's a more important word, we. Because we have. And so if you live somewhere where community isn't happening, then this is, you know, this is at least a means of establishing some of that. And that's, you know, that's part of why we get that's part of the why the commentary comes in that does about how much people do value what's going on here. I got a note, and I got to ask him if it's okay if I share it. I got a note from our buddy Harry in Baltimore that is sort of an extensive explanation of what the horn means to him, and it just absolutely rocked me because of its erudition, its intelligence, and the clarity with which he defines in ways that I, who've been doing this, can't even define it. So, you know, community, I guess what I'm saying is community is not accidental. Community is often what the people who do the oppressing try to keep down. I was not kidding when I said earlier that in the old days of, because I heard about this through my own family, in the older days of the coal camp that was this town, if two families were seen by the company to be breaking bread together on Sunday afternoon after church, those two families were liable to be thrown out on the streets and the men blacklisted from ever being able to work in coal mining again, because absent any evidence whatsoever, it was assumed that they were union organizing. Okay? And what is that if it is not an attempt to make sure community does not form?
But don't you see, I was a union rep for 28 years, and the problem here is it's the union needs to be a worldwide union. We need to have.
Hey, I'm right there. You're making the IWW argument. Big union.
We need to have, if you had a world strike, but I don't think that's ever possible. But I'm just saying we need basic pay. When I say pay, not money, they need basics for human beings to work a minimum amount of time for a reasonably good quality of life, not a great quality of life.
Oh, but what you see is that in some nations that can happen. Lufthansa just canceled a whole bunch of flights in anticipation of the fact that Lufthansa pilots were going to walk. In France, if the garbage workers go, the sanitation workers go on strike, the teachers and the bus drivers and the pilots and the judges will go on strike.
But that is
attitudinal, and I would suggest, Jeff, that is a function of them still having a sense of community, whereas in the years following the Second World War, there was a decided attempt made in the United States to absolutely defeat the idea of community. That's why, right. Just as one little bit of trivia, that's why all the tract housing that went up after the Second World War eliminated porches. And we went from having a porch to a stoop. And you can't get together with your neighbors on your front stoop.
Well, actually, they do in Brooklyn.
Well, yeah, that's not what I immediately flashed on, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about houses like the one I grew up in. It was maybe 5 feet wide with two steps.
There was a concerted effort in this country after the 40s, in the mid-40s, to literally turn the system so it functions, so the big guys make the bucks.
Because isolation always inures to the benefit of the oppressor. I just got a note from Irish Dave a minute ago that really struck me with its profundity. He said, "Why am I reminded of Stephen Biko's statement that the most powerful weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the minds of the oppressed?"
By the way, that's my whole push. The true value of human beings is in the minds and the labor of humanity. That's the goal. It's not the fancy car, the fancy computer. It's in the mind that designs those things. That's the true value of the world. I'm sorry, I'm going off on my I got my hammer, so everything looks like a nail.
Yeah, I know. But I gotta roll, Jeff, because I want to get some other calls.
Thank you. I enjoy it, and you did a great job. And did anybody kick in any money while we're talking?
Yes, we did. We did. We are now at only. Wait a second. We are now only $50 away from meeting Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge, and big thanks going out to our buddy Tom out in the Bay Area.
Okay, well, come on, one more. You guys out there, you got those fancy computers, you got that internet service, you're going to go another $25-$30.
Thank you, Jeff. Have a good one.
Have a good one.
Bye now. Our buddy Jeff down in Florida. And he's just fired up all my curiosity. Now I have to go wandering around Google Earth figuring out where Jeff is. I've been having ever since I reread the whole John D. McDonald, Travis McGee series, I've been having a little bit of Florida fascination. And I got to have something to keep my mind occupied. Especially, you know, when the interweb tubes went out about midnight last night and we're not back until like an hour before airtime, and I just figured, well, we're toast. And you know, when you're internet based, and that's the source of that's the sole means by which we disseminate content, that's a lot like just being plumb screwed. But I'm glad, I appreciate it. They actually got the system back up and running. Now let's talk a little bit about what Jack was talking about with redundancy and alternate routing and stuff like that. What a lovely concept that would be. Irish Dave pointing out the single family home for the nuclear family is one of the most useful marketing tools of the 1%. Safe nukes, anyone? Yeah, safe nuclear families that don't go out and form community bonds and don't act like neighborhoods and sit huddled in the warm glow of the electric TV box and get told what the people with money figure they need to know. And isn't it interesting that, and I don't know to what degree, I'm going right back to the phones. Lines open, 304-658-3333. Jeff was on Skype. That's clear now, too. I don't know to what degree that the religion industry knows that they are the useful idiots of the 1%, but they are. You know those family values that they're forever preaching about? That's the family values of the single-family nuclear family unit of the second half of the 20th century, because the real family values that made what passes for success in America possible is the extended family, the family that obtained before the rise, say, of the nursing home, where three generations would exist in the same house at the same time, not out of poverty, but because there is a duty of the adult age set both to raise the next generation and to take care of the generation that raised them. In essence, you can say, and it would be a delightful thing to say to right-wingers out there, hey, that Social Security you hate? That's the very essence of family values, you dumbass. Because it is a promise made by the working class to take care of the elder class, and it is a promise that is paid on, that is paid forward to the young, who will then. But you know, to try to get that through to a Paul Ryan. Good luck. Back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening.
Hey, Bill, what's happening?
Well, I just went offline for a minute and had to call you back. What they did is they put me on a goddamn variation of the cell phone. I'm talking on a landline phone, but it's running into the cell system, because Bell is the local. We were having trouble with them.
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring that up, because one of the modern trends is to go slowly but surely, and maybe not as slowly as we think. Phone companies are abandoning the concept of the regulated landline. I don't know if you realize that or not.
But it
used to be a matter of right that if you had a residence, you could get phone service, you know, as long as the bill paid. But that right does not occur with cell service.
Yeah. Well, I mean, now, I had a buddy who was an early guy into cell phones. I'm talking 30 years ago, and he got up to about 70K a year, and all of a sudden they came along and they dumped him, hired two kids for $25,000 apiece, and the boss put the balance, put the rest of the money in his own pocket, in his own retirement. This is what's going on in this capitalist system that I don't know if you can work with these guys. I mean, the last caller was, I agree, first of all, I agree with both of you guys that something had better be done, but it's not going to affect me. Let's face it, I'm not going to be around for the, I hope, you know, for the finale. I'm that old, I wouldn't know what's going on anyhow, so what's the difference? I don't know if you can work with these people. Having gone through that, you know, when the anti-Vietnam crowd got a real hold on things, Bob?
The anti-crowd?
Yep.
What, the Summer of Love was 1967 and...
You can throw that crap out the window. I went to a lot of these anti-war rallies where a lot of it was, hey, are there any good women around here? It was the guys coming home.
Sure, yeah.
And talking about what they had seen and what had been done and how they felt about the whole.
Yeah, it was the ordinary man on the street version of what happened to George Romney when he got back.
Oh, yeah, Romney blew the whistle.
Yeah, because you brought that up a couple of nights ago, and it's very true.
They blew him right off the top spot in the Republican ticket. I don't know what we do with people who have so damn much money and power, and they can't seem to get enough of it. It's beyond reason, Bob. That's my problem. And I'd have to say that what you talked about, the Colton, you know, two guys having dinner together with the families on Sunday, after church, no doubt.
Yeah, that's not a joke, Bill. That's very real.
No, it's not. Well, it's sure what I would call a very sick... If it's a joke, it's a sick one, you know? Well, what it does with me is I get that sardonic smile on my face.
Well, I just reiterate that I'm not making stuff up. I mean, this is stuff that was handed down through the family by way of, you know, never forget.
Well, you'd know it better than me because I saw a lot of people hear this idea of the hating labor unions. They said, what's the matter with these people? Do they have a brain between their ears? Me, I had a great day. A musician buddy of mine came over, picked me up, took me to a place in the Tremont area, which is where we went past the high school that Mr. Kucinich went to, a little Catholic school, because I went there for a few days until I said, I don't like this place either, and go back to the library and read some more. I don't know. I mean, things just, you can't, people don't, there's so many people out there that don't understand how bad the job situation. And as I say, the movie that we saw, the classic coal mining movie.
Which one?
You know the name of it. What,
Matewan? Matewan? Matewan?
Yes. Yes, there's a classic right there. I mean, all the truth of how these men acted in all these situations, these guys were brutal, Bob. I don't know if the mafia, you know, organized crime, I won't use the term mafia, just say organized crime of any kind. I don't care who's running it, you know. Because I think there was a group of people from the Emerald Isle in New York City in the 1860s and through there, you know. They were on top of them. You know, there's always some people who, they can't make enough money. They got to steal a little more on top of it. That's what's so hurtful.
And
that's why it's so hard to reason with people. You can't reason.
Well, there's no reasoning with Don Blankenship. I don't know if you've heard that clip yet, but he keeps coming back. I mean, it's very clear that he has been schooled hard. He has spent long hours in the woodshed being prepped on this.
Yep. And that's
because he has, he funded the film. They made the film. They engaged in a lot of sleazy, slimy, slippery tactics to make the film. And then he hired a PR firm to go out and some PR person contacted MSNBC and said, would you like to have?
Yep.
And there sat Don saying, well, I just want to tell the real story unless we're just going to have more of this media bias. I mean, Jesus, really?
Well, the truth.
Well, what struck me is that Let's put it this way. I would love to have horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner watch this thing, and then get back to me on just do a quick, you know, on video diagnosis of this guy, because he is not able to comprehend personal responsibility. Nothing can ever be Don Blankenship's fault. And beyond that, when I made the remark about he leaves a trail behind him of death and destruction, the man grins like he enjoys killing. I mean, he smirked, and to me it was a sociopath's smirk.
Well, I have to point it at the brown shirts and the extreme Nazis and the Japanese military machine. I don't know if we took lessons from them anymore today with our own behavior. As I said, one of the books I have and one of the machines is The Rape of Nanking, and I have to read it in segments because my stomach only takes so much, you know. And my stomach's feeling pretty good. My buddy took me to a restaurant that's been in business for 40 years and got good chicken paprikash and sauerkraut.
Oh, chicken paprikash? Whoa!
Yeah.
Whoa!
Well, my grandmother made the stuff when I was a kid, and I said, Grandma, can I have a hamburger? Stupid kid, you know. Ignorant little kid. Yeah, you hit it on the head, Bob. The dispersal of the family. It's a because you saw the family up close and personal.
Yeah.
No, that's something about the working class. Here we had it amongst people who were from the same ethnic groups. We had 33 councilmen in the city because we had to have one for every little ethnic group, you know. And people were happy when that was, of course, the city doesn't have enough people for 33 councilmen anymore. And I tell you what, when they started cutting back on council, the business people really liked it. Less people to bribe, you understand?
Sure.
Because, again, those sons of bitches can't save it. I mean, I'm a cheap little son of a bitch. That's how I learned to, I'm going to help my second wife. Well, why don't you take your car to the oil change place? I said, look, they're charging me $27 when I can buy an oil filter for $2.50 and a case of oil for $12 in those days. Come on now.
Right, sure.
Because I would take that money and blow it on, well, I have one fishing rod that cost me about $90. Of course, I have a picture of me holding a 7-pound walleye that I got with that rod standing on the shoreline. Because the place I was fishing is a water outlet for one of the electric companies. Warm water draws shad. You know what shad draws?
No.
Large walleye.
Yeah.
Hey, that 7-pounder is good, but I saw a buddy of mine come into the bar, the Euclid Tavern, where I played for 20-some years. He was rolling up with ice cream. He had at least an 11 and maybe another 10 with it. You know, because that be, again, you have to read the damn fishing books. Hey, Bob, I had a good American neighbor, a good Kentucky guy, taught me how to catch the damn things. He grew up catching them as a kid, and, you know, that's where we used to operate. You pass along your knowledge. I don't care if it was how to rebuild a carburetor, how to catch a fish, how to do some plumbing work, or whatever it was expected of us. I don't know why.
Because those are survival skills.
Yeah, yeah. Gardening. I have a friend who raises chickens, and I can remember being 4 or 5 years old, and well, I'm born 43, so this is like right after the war. I was just starting to get aware of things, you know. And I wakened to the sound of a rooster crowing, and now I understand that this passive laws in the Cleveland proper. That you're allowed to grow, that you're allowed to raise poultry again. Of course, down by the lake, I also saw some of the biggest goddamn rats I ever saw in my life. I said, where's my goddamn 22, you know?
Yeah.
Except when you're down on a dock with a lot of rocks around, you look out in front of that thing and everybody's ducking, you know?
Yeah, no kidding.
Well, a buddy of mine in Arizona, he killed two rattlers in his house. And he lives on the edge of a national park down there, so well, that's part of living. When you, I don't know, you guys got, what do they call them, the snake that's so prevalent, I shouldn't say pop.
Oh, copperheads?
Yeah, because a buddy of mine, a musician, goes down to a little cottage he has in Tennessee, and he killed a couple last year. I know it's cruelty to animals, but those people are, those little snakes are, they're not that little.
Don't tell that to a granny out there hoeing her, her half runners when one of those things shows up. That's just going to be dead copperhead.
And Bob, this tears the living crap out of me. The cynicism eats you alive because your last caller, I forget who it was.
Jeff.
Jeff, yeah. Because, you know, ethically, the man's so, quote, he's so on the money, I'm surprised he can sit on it and be that close to hard coins. You know what I mean? He's on the subject. There's no argument as far as what we need to do. But you ever hear Woody Guthrie's song called Tom Joad?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
We must be one big soul. Because the thing is, that's what it takes. And there seems to be always some people who are so against other people so bad that they can't get off a dead center. I don't know what the hell, you know, because this, well, you and I are World War I characters, aren't we? We go back and look at that, and that was a big turning point where it's like the, one thing Stalin did was hold up three of his best armies around Berlin after the war so he could put them on trains, ship them west through Siberia and go into Manchuria and beat the Japanese to dust in Manchuria. I mean, God dang it, the Japanese were so badly overrun. Of course, they had nothing left to fight with either, the idiots. The fact that they were still being army idiots, you know, high ups, keep fighting, fellas. Insanity is hard to deal with, is what it amounts to, Bob.
Well, I think you're right. And by the way, you got a really nice note in from our buddy Steve. He said, someday I'd love to have a potluck dinner with the Horn family folks. He said, I so want to meet Bill. He started laughing. He said, maybe it's some sort of gay crush.
Well, I try, I don't talk much during dinner.
The more you're talking, the less you're eating. And now we're back to the chicken paprikash. Wow.
Oh, well, my mother's first husband was Italian, and his mother taught her how to do the meatballs and pasta. And I'm still good at that stuff. It kind of bothers me that I'm not cooking like I used to. Because right now, my piano player trucks me around pretty good. And we went to, well, in fact, my friend Colin, the big guy who's doing the recordings and such, he dragged me over to an Italian store yesterday and up on Mayfield Road. And, Bob, you can't walk in that place. The smell of the cheeses alone
just knock you down.
You know, you're choking on your own saliva, you know? So what can I tell you? But there's so many things, and you can't listen to a damn sports show without combat coming into it. You know, these battle terms that come up in these guys. Hey, come on, this is literally, this started as a game. Although there's a good book called America's Game about pro football, and that's a great chapter when they were merging what was left of the All-America Football Conference, you know, Browns, 49ers, and believe it or not, a team that was based in Dallas that fell apart and they moved it to Baltimore, which is why the Baltimore Colts were in the Western Conference of the National Football League.
Well, I never knew that. I always kind of wondered.
Yeah, well, me too. I said, man, this guy must have fought geography badly. But I mean, I'm so cynical because of the war things. As I said, that war didn't seem to start to break down until the men who fought it started coming home. And you know, one of the guys that was the nastiest during that war, Civil War, was Sherman. if people can pick up speeches he made to the veterans of his, you know, his Atlanta campaign and the March to the Sea, you know, he was brutal about what war was.
Well, he's the one that gave us war as hell, ma'am.
Yeah. Well, he just began to do the first, what we did with bombs, his men did on foot.
Well, I think an argument is to be made that the American Civil War is a dress rehearsal for the 20th century. Because you've got all the elements there that would come to such bloody flower in 1914. You've got balloons in the air, you've got electronic communications in the form of the telegraph, you've got the real first bloody use of trench warfare, and the casualty numbers. You know, we went over that the other day. The casualty numbers from the Crimea and the casualty numbers from the Civil War are similar in as far as ever so many of the deaths happened not from a bullet wound itself, but from what would later become treatable disease.
Yeah, gas, gangrene, and you name it, was getting people. It's a shame. I mean, why? It hurts, and people still...
Also, the other thing that often gets overlooked is the brutal. Now, granted, the British are credited with the formal invention of the concentration camp during the Boer War.
Yep.
But when you take places like Andersonville and little-known places like Cahaba, Alabama, we recognize that the brutalization of people who had been taken out of the war itself and simply imprisoned, that rears its head in the American Civil War, too.
Well, Elmira, New York, and the place that I have visited, because it's down here, one of the biggest amusement parks and recreation areas in Ohio, around Sandusky, is great prime fishing grounds. There's tons of...
Oh, see, you already mentioned the magic word. You said walleye, and love me some walleye.
Well, Bob... Well, the Canadians were funny. When I went up to Rice Lake near Peterborough, they limited you to 15 to take home, and if they stopped you, the Ontario police that were specialists in that kind of stuff, they'd confiscate your boat if they caught you with too many walleye. Because you had to leave them.
I'd rather sit there and fish in camp and fry them up in a pan over the open fire.
Yeah. Well, what killed me, I'd see him up there I think I went up there 6 years running, and every time I went up, we were going up in August, and the fishing was really bad. I said to my second wife, how come we're coming up here in August? She says, well, that's when my brother's little league teams were over. Oh, good. Because prime fishing is springtime. I mean, buddy, the name crappie, it may be crappie to somebody, but they were a tremendous fish for panfish. Eating.
Oh yeah, no, yeah. Crappie, sure, absolutely. I had a little piece of pan fried. I had a meeting I had to attend earlier today, and it took me over to Beckley. And Ferg and I each had a little piece of pan fried trout that was that they serve up with lemon brown butter. Holy cow! Oh my God, it's so good.
Well, there was a place that raised trout up here, and you could go there, and for $7 or $8, you could fish for a few hours, and
Pay Lake?
You were limited, you know, but you brought home a pile of it, guys, because they were raising trout for restaurants, and they put them out in ponds.
Sure.
So you could, you know, but they were, that's a tough fish to cook for me. I was married to two women who could take a piece of cardboard and make it taste like something. They were both.
Oh, yeah.
One was of Jewish extraction, and she made chopped liver in the delicatessen style that every time I talk to her, I bug her. When are you going to bring people guys to
the now you're just, Bill, now you're just hurting me.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The second wife was of German extraction, and she made the chicken liver in a mix with gravy and bacon and some other. I'm gonna need some of that bacon. I'm not dying fast enough.
Hey, Bill, I gotta run along, but it's been a great conversation.
People, and I've run my course, and you know, that's one thing about music. I played yesterday on a local TV show, and actually stood up through it and played well from what they told me. But okay, you know, I guess
I heard about that. That's awesome.
Well, yeah, there was three harmonica players, no waiting. You know, that was kind of ridiculous. I had to think like a New Orleans clarinet player and constantly play around what they were doing. Play that second line, the obligato, whatever you want to call it. Hey, go ahead, man. Have a good one, and I hope you got good people lined up, because I need the entertainment.
All right, Bill. Thanks so much. You take care and have a good night.
Thanks.
Bye now. Our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress, calling from Cleveland. And yes, indeed, he did make a right dandy appearance recently. Try to find a link, and maybe I'll tweet it out or something so the rest of y'all can find it on Facebook or my Twitter feed or whatever. Just a reminder, we are only $50 away now, thanks to Sal and Gene and David and Tom. We're only $50 away now from meeting Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge, in which everybody who contributes up to $150 gets their money doubled. So thanks very much for those who have contributed. And hopefully in the remaining 7 minutes, we will find the remaining $50 so that Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge can become, in fact, reality. Back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, quickly, how are you doing?
Pretty good, I guess.
Calm down?
Well, now, why would I not be calm?
I'm not going to even touch that with a 10-foot pole. First, this thing about Germany and all of its efforts to become, I guess, free of natural fracking. Hell, they don't have to. Have you looked at the statistics from Gazprom and what they're using since 2011?
Yeah, I have. And I also...
60% of their gas comes from Gazprom from Siberia.
Right, but the overall operating strategy was to get free of that as well. That's why on May the 29th, 2012, electrical generation from solar sources alone exceeded 50%, and why the previous winter there was so much wind energy being generated in Germany.
Then why are they using more? Because they're using more, 60% more, according to what I just saw.
Because they took their nuclear reactors offline, Jim.
Oh, well, okay, whatever. But I'm
and they took, yeah. they bless their hearts, they acted very, they were really, really quick and proactive in the wake of the Fukushima disaster. They just said, stop it now.
Well, that may be true, and that may be wise.
Well, it is true.
But still, what they're doing is they are using more and more Russian gas from Siberia. That is indisputable. And they're going to continue to do it.
And I think that's likely insofar as, for instance, their coal-fired electricity company, as Albert discussed, posted a $7 billion loss last year. But the ultimate goal is to get away from hydrocarbons altogether, because one of the nicest things you can say about the European nations is that they acknowledge that climate change is a reality and that hydrocarbon usage is the prime mover in it.
Why are they still using Gazprom from
because, Jim, they're trying to transition.
Well, they're not doing a really good job of it, according to what I've read.
I think real good job is a fluid term if you use it in comparison to, say, the United States, which struggles to deploy even minuscule amounts of renewable energy.
Well, I mean, look at the size of the areas that are being serviced.
Well, sure.
Germany is using more than Italy and France than any country in Europe, and Russia has them by the balls.
And as noted, you know, France's nuclear reactors are still online. Therefore, they don't have that need.
Well, still, I'm just saying, you're talking about the fracking and hydrocarbon industry. Well, still, Putin has them by the balls, and that's exactly what's going to decide this whole thing. He's got his finger on the pipeline. That's just my opinion. That's all there is to it.
Yeah, I understand that.
And, you know, I don't think that Germany, I've been in Germany. me a lot longer than you have, son. And I see.
Okay, Jim, don't son me. Don't son me.
Well, whatever.
If you were not there, no, I'm sure you've been there longer than I have. Were you there in 2012? Have you been there recently? There has been a great deal of change.
Well, I was there in 2009.
There had been great change even in those 3 years. I mean, it was amazing. Once they got the feed-in tariff in, and the governmental subsidy of the placement of solar panels and the building of industrial wind, like I said, in the winter previous to May the 29th, 2012, they had an instance where they were generating so much wind energy, word went out to please use more electric appliances. Take the load off the system.
Then why are they using all this Russian gas?
Because it's a large population, and I just explained to you that they took their nuclear reactors offline wisely. They are engaged in a transition, which is more than can be said for the United States by a long shot.
I wasn't attempting to compare Germany and the United States. I was simply making a point of...
No, that's the thing. The European Union is trying... I mean, look, great. Scotland has set a goal of being hydrocarbon free. Great Britain is struggling because of the nature of its conservative government. Arguably, and I think it's difficult to argue with, the French have a southern exposure, as do the Mediterranean states like Italy and Greece, that Germany doesn't have.
Well, on the other hand,
if you want to look at the Netherlands have ramped up their importation of American coal, much of which is mountaintop removal coal.
Well, that's not good for you, is it?
That's not good for you either. You live here too.
Well, whatever I'm saying. But nonetheless, as far as the hydrocarbon industry is concerned, and what I wish to point out is, and I pointed out before, it's just not fuel. It's fertilizer and stuff like that. Now, how are they going to replace all of that with fertilizer,
There's nothing that says everything is going to be replaced, but it is also finite, Jim. And knowing that we have to go to greater extremes in order to extract it, we need to be wiser in its use.
Well, what about fertilizers and things of that nature? Can you give me any figures on that, please?
Jim, I'm not sitting here pulling up figures while we're talking.
Nor am I. I'm just asking the question because I know how much fertilizer companies depend on hydrocarbons and things of that nature.
Sure, nitrates, that is.
Exactly.
Sure.
Exactly. And, pursuant to... Well, the reference to the last caller and Civil War concentration camps, somebody mentioned Andersonville, did they not?
That was me.
Okay. Well, take a look at Camp Douglas out of County Chicago.
No. Both sides did it. Absolutely.
That wasn't a very nice place either. As a matter of fact, it was only because of the good efforts of a Catholic priest that many of those people survived.
There was one tragedy that absolutely, at the end of the war when people were trying to... Oh, goodness me, we're out of time. What was the name of the steamship that blew up, taking prisoners away from Cahaba? But we're out of time, Jim. You have a good evening. And so we find ourselves, well, I ran overtime, dadgummit. I do love a good conversation. Thanks very much to Karen for jumping in, helping with this evening's fundraising. That puts us finished with Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge. Thank you very much, Karen. Karen says, from Gary and Karen, thanks, Shirley, for putting out this challenge. Y'all have a great evening. Later now.